Monday to you. Thanks again for tuning in to another edition of Cam and Company, fueled by Hornady here on NRA TV, Sirius XM Patriot 125 and more. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. The right of the people to keep and to bear arms shall not be infringed. That is not that difficult a concept for me, but apparently we live in a world in which that is a bridge too far for five justices on the U.S. Supreme Court. The court concluding its spring term today and deciding not to hear the Peruta case. Now, we had a written dissent by Justice Clarence Thomas, joined by Justice Neil Gorsuch, the newest member of the court. Remember, it takes four justices to agree to hear a case. It takes five to win a case. And it's fair to say that the justices may have their own reasons for deciding whether or not they want to hear a case. It may have to do with their own personal considerations. It may be a strategic decision. Don't want to take a vote if you don't think you can win the case. Don't want to take the case if you think you're going to lose, which I guess is sort of the same thing, just said in a different way. Now, the NRA ILA's Chris Cox issued a statement not long ago, said, "We are disappointed in the court's rejection of the appeal in Peruta versus California, which now leaves millions of law-abiding Californians with no ability to bear arms outside of the home." That is absolutely correct. There are millions of Americans who are being denied a constitutional right at this moment. The court could have stepped in and addressed this and provided a redress, but it chose not to. As Justice Thomas and Gorsuch correctly stated, Chris Cox said, "Too many courts have been treating the Second Amendment as a second-class right. That should not be allowed to stand. As the Supreme Court stated in its landmark decision in Heller versus District of Columbia, the Second Amendment guarantees an individual right to keep and bear arms for self-defense. The framers of our Constitution did not intend to limit that right to the home. We look forward," he says, "to a future court affirming that the right to keep and bear arms is as much a part of our Constitution as the other enumerated rights that it protects. We will not stop fighting," Chris Cox says, "until a future court affirms this fundamental right." Now, we're going to talk about this afternoon. Kurt Schlichter, California attorney, is going to join us in hour three. Also, in hour two, Dennis Santiago of Dennis Talks Guns will join us. Stacey Washington from Stacey on the Right is going to be with us here in about 20 minutes, not only talk about the Peruta case, but she is the cover model. She's not the cover model. She's the cover girl for America's First Freedom magazine this month. It's awesome to see. We'll talk about the Peruta case with Stacey also later this hour. Carrie Pickett of the Daily Caller. There she is. Look at that. We knew her way back when. Nicole Russell of the Federalist in hour two says it's time to allow concealed carry permits in Washington, D.C. Plus Tim Lee with the Center for Individual Freedom. But we're going to talk right now a little bit more about the Peruta case. So you heard what Chris Cox said. Very, very powerful language, very strong language. We're not going to give up. And there are other cases. In fact, there is a Peruta 2 case that is already in the pipeline. So we're going to go through some of the background of this case. But I want to start with the dissenting opinion written by Justice Thomas today. Again, joined in this dissent by Neil Gorsuch. Basically say, listen, we should have taken this case. Now, I'm going to read this to you. I'm going to leave out the legal citations. I'm going to read this to you like it would be an argument you would be hearing from a judge or an attorney. Much more conversational than a legal brief. Justice Thomas said, "The Second Amendment to the Constitution guarantees that the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. At issue in this case is whether that guarantee protects the right to carry firearms in public for self-defense. Neither party disputes that the issue is one of national importance or that the courts of appeals have already weighed in extensively. I," he says, "would therefore grant the petition for a writ of certiorari." I would accept this case. And then he lays out why. He says, "California generally prohibits the average citizen from carrying a firearm in public spaces, either openly or concealed. With a few limited exceptions, the state prohibits open carry altogether. It prescribes concealed carry unless a resident obtains a license by showing good cause, among other criteria. And it authorized counties to set rules for when an applicant has shown good cause. In the county where the petitioners reside, in this case Mr. Peruta and others, the sheriff has interpreted good cause to require an applicant to show that he has a particularized need, substantiated by documentary evidence, to carry a firearm for self-defense. The sheriff's policy specifies that concern for one's personal safety does not alone satisfy this requirement. Instead, an applicant must show a set of circumstances that distinguish the applicant from the mainstream, that distinguish this applicant from the mainstream and cause him to be placed in harm's way. In other words, the right to carry is not a mainstream right. It is a privilege that is exercised by a few who are not in the mainstream. The mainstream of society, according to the policies in San Diego County, do not have the right to carry a firearm. Back to the dissenting opinion. A typical citizen, fearing for his personal safety, by definition cannot distinguish himself from the mainstream. As a result, ordinary, law-abiding, responsible citizens may not obtain a permit for concealed carry of a firearm in public spaces. The petitioners are residents of San Diego County, plus an association with numerous county residents as members, who are unable to obtain a license for concealed carry due to the county's policy, and because the state generally bans open carry, are thus unable to bear firearms in public in any manner. They sued, alleging that this near-total prohibition on public carry violates their Second Amendment right to bear arms. They requested declaratory and injunctive relief to prevent the sheriff from denying licenses based on his restrictive interpretation of good cause, as well as other relief that the court deems just and proper. The district court granted the respondent's motion for summary judgment, and the petitioners appealed to the Ninth Circuit. In a thorough opinion, Justice Thomas says, a panel of the Ninth Circuit reversed that lower court decision. The panel examined the constitutional text and this court's precedents, as well as historical sources from before the founding era through the end of the 19th century. Based on these sources, the court concluded that, quote, the carrying of an operable handgun outside the home for the lawful purpose of self-defense constitutes bearing arms within the meaning of the Second Amendment. It thus reversed, Thomas says, the district court and held that the sheriff's interpretation of good cause in combination with the other aspects of the state's regime violated the Second Amendment's command that a state permit some form of carry for self-defense outside of the home. The Ninth Circuit granted a rehearing en banc and by a divided court reversed that panel decision. In the en banc court's review, because petitioners specifically asked for the invalidation of the sheriff's good cause interpretation, their legal challenge was limited to that aspect of the applicable regulatory scheme. The court thus declined to answer the question of whether or to what degree the Second Amendment might or might not protect a right of the member of the general public to carry firearms openly in public. It instead held that only that the Second Amendment does not preserve or protect a right of the member of a member of the general public to carry concealed firearms in public. Justice Thomas says we should have granted certiorari in this case. The approach taken by the en banc court is indefensible, and the petition raises important questions that this court should address. I see no reason, he says, to await another case. Justice Thomas, joined by Justice Gorsuch, said the en banc court's decision to limit its review to whether the Second Amendment protects the right to concealed carry as opposed to the more general right to public carry was untenable. Most fundamentally, it was not justified by the terms of the complaint, which called into question the state's regulatory scheme as a whole. And although the complaint specified the remedy that intruded least on the state's overall regulatory regime, declaratory relief and an injunction against the sheriff's restrictive interpretation of good cause, it also requested any further relief as the court deems just and proper. Nor, Justice Thomas says, was the Ninth Circuit's approach justified by the history of this litigation. The district court emphasized that the, quote, heart of the party's dispute is whether the Second Amendment protects the right to carry a loaded handgun in public, either openly or in a concealed manner. As the Ninth Circuit panel pointed out, The petitioners argue that the second, that the San Diego County policy, in light of the California licensing scheme as a whole, violates the Second Amendment because it precludes a responsible law-abiding citizen from carrying a weapon in public for the purpose of lawful self-defense in any manner. The panel further observed that although the petitioners focus their challenge on the licensing scheme for concealed carry, this is for good reason. Acquiring such a license is the only practical avenue by which they may lawfully carry a gun for self-defense in San Diego County. Even the en banc court, Justice Thomas says, acknowledged that the petitioners, quote, base their argument on the entirety of California's statutory scheme and do not contend that there is a freestanding Second Amendment right to carry concealed firearms. So in other words, Justice Thomas says the court answered a question that wasn't asked, went out of its way to answer a question that wasn't asked in order to arrive at a decision that would prevent the issuing of concealed carry licenses in San Diego County. Had the en banc Ninth Circuit answered the question actually at issue in this case, Justice Thomas writes, it likely would have been compelled to reach the opposite result. This court, he says, has already suggested that the Second Amendment protects the right to carry firearms in public in some fashion. As we explained in Heller, he says, to bear arms means to, quote, wear, bear, or carry upon the person, or in the clothing or in a pocket, for the purpose of being armed and ready for offensive or defensive action in a case of conflict with another person. The most natural reading of this definition, he says, encompasses public carry. And this is one of the money quotes from Justice Thomas here. He says, I find it extremely improbable that the framers understood the Second Amendment to protect little more than carrying a gun from the bedroom to the kitchen. That's not what bearing arms meant, to carry a gun from the bedroom to the kitchen. The relevant history, Justice Thomas writes, appears to support this understanding. The panel opinion below pointed to a wealth of cases and secondary sources from England, the founding era, the antebellum period, and Reconstruction, which strongly together suggested the right to bear arms includes the right to bear arms in public in some manner. He cites, by the way, the brief for the National Rifle Association, for example, none versus the state. That's the one citation that I'll tell you. He says this is a decision that the Heller Court discussed extensively as illustrative of the proper understanding of the right. He says, finally, the Second Amendment's core purpose further supports the conclusion that the right to bear arms extends to public carry. The court in Heller emphasized that self-defense is the central component of the Second Amendment right itself. This purpose is not limited only to the home, even though the need for self-defense may be the most acute there. And he says, even if other members of the court do not agree that the Second Amendment likely protects a right to public carry, the time has come for the court to answer this important question definitively. 26 states, he says, have asked us to resolve this question presented. 26 states. He says the lower courts have fully vetted the issue. At least four other courts of appeals, three state courts of last resort have decided cases regarding the ability of states to regulate the public carry of firearms. He says there are thorough opinions on both sides of the issue. Hence, I do not see much value in waiting for additional courts to weigh in, especially when constitutional rights are at stake. Justice Thomas says this court's decision to deny cert in this case reflects a distressing trend. This is another one of the big pull quotes here. The court's decision to deny certiorari in this case reflects a distressing trend, the treatment of the Second Amendment as a disfavored right. And then he cites a number of cases that have come before the court that the court has said, we're going to pass. He says, the Constitution does not rank certain rights above others, and I do not think this court should impose such a hierarchy by selectively enforcing its preferred rights. The court, Clarence Thomas says, has not heard argument in a Second Amendment case in over 7 years. Since March 2nd, 2010, in McDonald versus Chicago. Since that time, he says, we've heard argument in, for example, roughly 35 cases where the question presented turned on the meaning of the First Amendment, and 25 cases that turned on the meaning of the Fourth Amendment. 35 First Amendment cases in 7 years, 25 Fourth Amendment cases in 7 years, 0 Second Amendment cases in 7 years. This discrepancy, he writes, is inexcusable, especially given how much less developed our jurisprudence is with respect to the Second Amendment as compared to the First and Fourth Amendments. He concluded, for those of us who work in marbled halls, guarded constantly by a vigilant and dedicated police force. The guarantees of the Second Amendment might seem antiquated. He says, but the framers made a clear choice. They reserved to all Americans the right to bear arms for self-defense. I do not think, he writes, we should stand idly by while a state denies its citizens that right, particularly when their very lives may depend on it. I respectfully dissent. Clarence Thomas, again, joined by Justice Neil Gorsuch in that dissent. We're going to have much more on the Peruta case, including a look at the justification for this law by the sheriff of San Diego County. But I want to, before we take a break, I just want to let our listeners and our viewers in California know we haven't given up. Gun owners across the country are not turning our back on you. We're not forgetting you. You're not a lost cause. Our constitutional rights exist for each and every individual American, regardless of the zip code or the time zone that they live in. And I got to tell you, we will keep fighting. NRA members across this country are going to keep fighting to ensure that your rights and our rights, because it's the same right, are respected and recognized from coast to coast. All right, when we come back, Stacey Washington, host of Stacey on the Right, and the featured story in this month's America's First Freedom Magazine. She's going to be with us right after this, so stick around. We are just getting started here on this Monday edition of Cam & Company. Talking with Lieutenant Colonel Robert Ledee from the Armor for Troops Foundation. What is Armor for Troops all about? I mean, it sounds like it might be kind of self-explanatory, right?
We started this in 2005. We realized there was a lot of shortage of equipment overseas, so we started the foundation. We provide anti-ballistic eyewear, Under Armour, multifunction tools, knee pads, elbow pads, antibacterial clothing. You know, you don't, Marines and all military in the war zone don't shower for 2 or 3 weeks. At that point, only your mother will love you. But we provide equipment. We're doing boots, boot pads. We started doing some vests, but they got so expensive we couldn't do it anymore.
Wow, that's still an amazing amount of material that you all are able to supply free of charge to these members of the military.
The boxes we were standing in had a retail of $750 of all the stuff we put in it. In addition to all the equipment, we also put in batteries, toothpaste, toothbrush, disposable shavers, deodorant, clear eyes, lip thing. We had face wipes, hand wipes, foot powder. So we put a big box together.
That is fantastic. And this is all volunteer-driven?
Yes, it is. We have zero salaries. Everybody is a volunteer, have been for over 10 years, and no one gets paid anything here.
And how many people have you been able to help since 2005?
Well, we sent out over 46,000 pairs of eyewear alone. So you got to say we've helped over 46,000 people. Doesn't count the thousands of Under Armour and multifunction tools, et cetera.
That is incredible. Was there anything like this when you were active duty?
No. And I did 31 years in the Marine Corps. So because of what was happening, especially going to a war zone, I remember what Secretary Rumsfeld said. You go to war with what you have, not with what you want. So we started figuring out that there was a shortage of things. We were going to do something that no one else has done. The military did offer equipment. We just gave them better grade equipment.
I was a normal 20-year-old college student. When I moved into off-campus housing, they boasted that it was safe. Not a single incident since it had opened. I was the first. I woke up in the middle of the night, suffocating. Shut up, he said. Don't say a word. For the next 2 hours, I knew I was going to die, and there was nothing I could do. Now I'm a mother of two, and if that predator or anyone else tries to harm me or my family, they have to come through my firearm first. I will never be unarmed or utterly vulnerable ever again. The only reason I can say that is because the NRA fought for my rights before I ever knew that I needed them. I'm the National Rifle Association of America, and I'm freedom's safest place.
Every animal that has ever roamed this planet was designed as hunted or hunter, predator or prey. We are hunters. If it were ever necessary, even the strictest vegan would return to the wild, driven to survive by the instincts of his ancestors. Those who hide behind the soft delusion of their own ignorance do so from within a civilization whose very being costs the lives of countless creatures every single day. Death is an undeniable fuel of life. This is the undeniable truth of existence. To live in balance with the planet that sustains us, we must admit and embrace the nature within us. Trust the hunter in your blood.
Welcome back to Cam and Company right here on NRA-TV, Sirius XM, Patriot 125, and more. Gary Pickett of the Daily Caller joins us a little bit later on in the hour talking about a new class action lawsuit filed against PayPal and other payment processors by a Fires merchant. About an hour from now, Nicole Russell of The Federalist. Right now, you might be seeing her in your mailbox this week. Stacey Washington, host of Stacey on the Right, is with us. Stacey, how are you?
I'm doing great.
Look at that. Look at that serious face there on the cover of America's First Freedom. Stacey in the Right. And you look, that's like your serious mom face, isn't it?
I didn't pick that picture. So I didn't even know what it looked like. I didn't know what they were going to use until it was already in print. So, you know, I'm working with
awesome.
These guys over there. I actually, when I first saw it, Cam, I was like, what? That face, I've never seen that face in public before. So he was like, you're going to love this. You're going to love it. Just go. He was like, I'm in the magazine business. I know what works. This picture is perfect. And so I was like, I'm just trusting you. So my husband and the kids loved it because I did get to see it about 4 days before it actually came into everybody's mailboxes. And then I started sharing it and the response was really positive. And so I'm really grateful that they even covered the story, that they let me write it, and that they put me on the cover was really just, you know, I'm so grateful.
Absolutely. Well, you've got a great story. You've got a great voice. And the fact that, you know, you're so outspoken on this issue, much to the chagrin and disappointment of some in the newspaper business there in St. Louis, Missouri. And you didn't let that stop you. I think that that speaks volumes. So I think your story, I'm glad that it is on the cover of America's First Freedom this month. Now, I've got to ask you, Stacey, you know, we were just talking about this before the break. Supreme Court today decided not to hear the Peruta case. This is the right to carry case out of California. Justice Thomas was very upset. Joined by Neil Gorsuch, says it is time for the court to consider this case. We've got lower courts. They've all chimed in. We know there's a variety of opinions out there. And there are millions of Americans, as he pointed out, who are impacted by this, who cannot carry. And we know, for example, Stacey, when this case was in the lower court, and at one point there was a ruling that said, yeah, you can't do this. You know, good cause is ridiculous. Self-defense is good cause. The sheriff of Orange County decided, all right, we're gonna actually recognize self-defense as a valid reason to carry. They went from issuing about 300 permits a year to within a couple of weeks having over 3,000 applications because people knew for the first time that they could actually get a license. So the demand for this is there in LA County. It's there in San Francisco. It's there in San Diego. You just can't get a license. The same license, by the way, that you could get if you live in Riverside, California, or if you live in Inland California. You know, that we've got a two-tier system of how strong are your Second Amendment rights in California right now.
And it's especially troubling for women because the majority of, you know, the concealed carry applications are going to be coming from women who are seeking orders of protection, which that's just a piece of paper that doesn't stop a stalker or an upset boyfriend or irate soon-to-be ex-husband or what have you from just saying, look, I've got a piece of paper here. This thing doesn't stop me from doing anything. I, you know, just ball it up, throw it in the trash. It really hinges on whether or not I want to abide by the law. Most people who end up assaulting someone, especially a woman, sexual assault, violent robberies, rapes, any of that stuff, these are not people who are going to say, oh, you gave me a piece of paper that says I have to stay away from her? Fine, I will. So this is a horrible travesty that the court chose not to take this case up. And I saw your tweet. I retweeted you where you quoted Justice Thomas, who he used some really fancy, I don't know if it's Latin or whatever the word is, but he said they should have taken up the case. This is important. I have actually written another piece that documents a number of cases, an astounding number of cases where women have used firearms to defend themselves against male attackers, not just saving their own lives, but sometimes the lives of family members like their parents, their siblings, et cetera, babies. All of these cases outlined with a clear, there is no way to mistake the connection between women owning firearms and being able to use them at will lawfully to defend themselves, and a lessening in crime and women walking away from these encounters unscathed, meaning not raped, not beaten, not robbed, not dead. So this is, it's sad to see, but we've got to keep bringing these cases up before the Supreme Court so we can get them to take down these artificial barriers between the lawful ownership and carriage of firearms that some of these municipalities and areas are erecting to the detriment of the people who live there.
Absolutely. And there are other carry cases out there. I think clearly we're probably going to need to see another retirement, you know, from the court to get a change. I don't think we've got the five votes right now, clearly, because the court keeps punting on these cases. So unless, you know, Justice Thomas can sway one of these justices to reconsider the currently held position, we're probably going to need another retirement, right? Unfortunately. But in the meantime, you know, and this is something that I think is really important. The NRA certainly is not waiting and putting all of its eggs in the Supreme Court basket. We've seen several states around the country adopt constitutional carry laws this session. We're at over a dozen states right now that either have or are considering constitutional carry laws. I believe we're at a dozen states where no license is needed for you to carry. We have over 40 states that are shall issue. And it's really important that we keep being active at the state level because we're building that case. We know one day the Supreme Court is going to hear this case. And one of the things that they're going to consider, Stacey, is the march of progress on this issue, quite frankly, going back 30 years to the state of Florida and the real right to carry revolution that we've seen since, where you've got now, you know, tens of millions of Americans who say they carry almost every day. Violent crime dropping the entire time that the number of concealed carry holders was growing in this country. You know, this is something that the court, I think, will consider. They won't just consider the law. I think they will consider, and I would encourage the justices on the left to consider this sort of living constitution. How is this right applicable to us today? Well, look at how many millions of Americans in places where they can carry legally are carrying legally. You want to see the living constitution in action? There it is. We are still seeing states pass legislation enshrining the Second Amendment into constitutions, into state constitutions. That was happening just, you know, 20, 30 years ago. Almost every state in the country now has one. So this right does live, even with a progressive view of the Constitution.
Well, and I saw another comment that Justice Thomas made. I believe he was talking about how they, as justices, they sit in a marbled hall with a highly trained, efficient police force that guards them at all times. And so from that perspective, from that perch, they tend to forget that in everyday life, women like me are walking around, driving around, and often alone in situations where we're outnumbered by men. And the robberies and assaults are not strictly the purview of men against women. Plenty of men are assaulted. Plenty of men are mugged and robbed. But from my perspective, with a court that has a lot of women on it, it's really odd to see them not see this as a really important issue for women. We need the ability to carry firearms concealed to protect ourselves. And men do as well. Any man can tell you if they've been in a situation where they're walking on a city street at night and you see a large group of men approaching, any man with any sense is going to be concerned about his safety as well. So I would love to see them take this up. But your point is well made, Cam. When we're looking at how we can impact the Second Amendment, the local level is the most fertile ground. We can impact our legislators. We can impact our governors and our state legislators and reps. We can talk to these people about the need to be free. We're one of those states, the 12 states that you mentioned that has shall issue. Although the patchwork of municipal laws here makes it difficult for you to apply the permitless carry as well as you'd like, at least we do have it, and the expansion of it is that much easier because it's already here. So, you know, if you're listening, get out there and work in your state. In the absence of the Supreme Court helping, we can still get this done on our own.
Talking again with Stacey Washington, who is on the cover of this month's America's First Freedom. Did you get a couple of extra copies, by the way, Stacey? I hope you got a couple of extra copies.
I asked for some, and I'm looking for them in my mailbox, but I'm like, where are my magazine copies? But I do have the, you know, he sent me a file with a picture, and I've been sharing that. The reactions have been so cool, because obviously there's this whole big thing going on right now because of a promo about me hating green beans. So it's all about me loving guns and hating green beans. That's this whole, like, past 5 days. It's been crazy.
That is awesome. I love it. We could probably spend the next couple of minutes talking about green beans, but let's go back to guns, if you don't mind. Because one of the other things that I think that we can do, we'll talk green beans later. We'll have you on the 40 Acres and a Fool podcast to talk about your absolute hatred of green beans.
Okay.
It's not easy being green bean. So back to the guns. You know, one of the things, Stacey, and this isn't even political, but one of the things, I mean, it is, but it isn't. One of the things I think that that is a struggle for us is, as Justice Thomas, you mentioned that quote about, you know, we're here in the marble hallways. Well, also, you know, there in D.C., where you've got this very restrictive gun regime that's been in effect for decades, New York City, it's not like these gun control laws are new, right? In many cases, people have grown up around them. They see them as the sort of, man, okay, this is the way it's always been. If you live in Texas or you live in Virginia, then you have a very different set of, meh, this is the way it's always been. But we can't deny, again, where the movement has been going, right? We've been going towards a recognition of the right to carry. And there are, again, tens of millions of Americans who are doing so each and every day. So I think it's time that culturally, honestly, you know, we've seen Chicago dragged kicking and screaming into simply be allowing a range to open up. I think those days are done and gone. I think there really needs to be a recognition on the left of, you know what, people are doing this right now. You're going to take this right away. We're hearing a lot of talk right now about healthcare, right? How many thousands of people are going to die if you take Obamacare away? Well, what's going to happen to those, let's say conservatively, 15 million Americans who are concealed carry holders right now? What happens if all of a sudden you take that away? And those individuals can no longer protect themselves. And if you're not going to do that, if you say that's not what it's about, then when does it actually become about fully accepting the right of Americans to carry?
Yeah, I would say there's the untold, incalculable effect. It's a side effect of having 15 million people carrying, which is you don't know where they are. I love pointing it out to liberals that at any moment of the day, they can be anywhere, at a bus stop, you know, gas station, the grocery store, church, and someone near them is carrying a firearm. They're not doing it because they're scary or they're horrible people or they're felons. They're carrying a firearm because not just are they willing to protect themselves, but they're willing to protect anyone in their vicinity from any attack that might occur, which oftentimes means when the bullets fly, the concealed carry holder is basically saying, I'm willing to be shot for you strangers. So I agree. It's time to move into acceptance. But if you look around the political arena right now, there's not a lot of acceptance coming from those who practice left politics or are gun control advocates. They really honestly believe that the people who have the lowest incidence of crime, law-abiding gun owners, lower incidence of crime than even the police, they really believe that at any moment we're all going to break out in internecine warfare and start just taking everybody out. When the truth is, it's the criminals. They're the ones who would love to see all of us disarmed because then they'd be free to roam about with impunity, being evil, murdering, raping, pillaging, stealing, doing whatever they want. The 15 million, that's what stands between Americans and that reality. And I know the police play a huge role. You know, I support the police, but the police can't be everywhere. And it's better for the criminals to be unsure as to who it is in the crowd who has a firearm. I tell you what, I've gotten on the elevator before and had a man jump on just before the doors close. And when I turn and look them in the face so I can see what their features are like, I'm communicating to them that I am not afraid to be alone on the elevator with that man. That is something that you can't do if you're not armed and prepared to defend yourself. So, you know, I do want acceptance, but in the interim, we just have to keep working.
Absolutely. All right. Last question before we run out of time here. The court did agree to hear the case involving the baker who did not want to bake a cake for the same-sex couple. So we're going to hear a religious liberties case, a First Amendment case. I'm curious your thoughts on the court deciding to hear, because those I think that case along with Peruta, those were probably the two most contentious cases that the court still had outstanding. They didn't take Peruta, they did take that one. I'm curious your take on that case.
I would say I want people to think about it this way, because a lot of people are saying, oh, you know, he should just bake the cake and shut up. Well, what about the people from earlier this year, the stars in Hollywood? Not stars, but designers, the ones who dress the stars. They said they wouldn't dress Melania Trump. Do you want to live in an America where Melania Trump can say, oh, yes, you will, and force people who design for a living to make clothes for her because they don't have the right to say no? And in the interim, beyond the cake and, you know, outfit debate, do you really want the government to say that your thoughts are not free? You can't have a disagreement with what someone's doing and say, I don't want to work with you, which means, I mean, it might work out great for me. I got projects here at the house. We've had people out to visit. A couple of them have said, well, we don't want to do that stucco work. You know, that's beyond the scope of what we normally do, or we're too busy to help you. Would you like it if I could call you to my house and say, I'll pay you to do this work? And if you say no, I say no, you will. Because that's where we will be if the Supreme Court decides that anyone can force an artist like a cake maker to make a cake for something that they find unconscionable by their religious beliefs or for whatever reason. So we're supposed to be the land of the free. We're supposed to be enshrining more freedom and respecting the Constitution. And I'm hoping that in the fall, when they come back from their break, they remember what the Constitution is supposed to do. It's supposed to protect individual liberty, not enable others to force the labor of other free individuals.
Stacey Washington, host of Stacey on the Right. Look for her in your mailbox this week in America's First Freedom. Stacey, as always, it is fantastic talking with you, and we'll do it again very soon.
Can't wait to talk to you. Have a great day.
All right. You too, Stacey Washington on Twitter, at Stacey on the Right, stacyontheright.com as well. When we return, Carrie Pickett from the Daily Caller on the new class action lawsuit against PayPal and other payment processors from a firearms merchant. Stick around. We'll get to that right after a quick timeout here on Cam and Company.
Time to do some special curators' corners with Jim Sapieca and Phil Schreier at the NRA Museums. You have collectors and really neat guns, guys, so let's get right into it. Who's first on the list?
We have Jennifer Gohl with the Winchester Arms Collectors Association. And, of course, the collectors bring the finest guns in the country here to the NRA annual meetings for display competition. This gun is not only one of our silver medal winners for the best guns in the show, this is a display that also won the overall best display in the show, and we're really excited to have it here.
Thank you.
Phil, tell us about what we have here.
Well, this is a Winchester Model 20. It's a 410 shotgun, and it's in the original case, and it has all of the accoutrements, including all the original boxes of 410 ammunition, actual clay targets, 100 midget clay targets in the original box.
Wow.
With the original paper on it. The gun, mint condition. All the oil.
Rust remover.
Jennifer and her husband, Gary, have been exhibiting on behalf of Winchester Arms Collectors and a number of other affiliated clubs that they're with for years. 32 years for the Winchester Club participating in this event.
Wow.
And this is... Jennifer, tell us what happened this morning at 9:30.
Well, we, of course, were... very much anticipating the awards meeting, And we won the silver medal for the junior trap shooting kit because it's totally complete. We also have the original shipping crate, which is back at our booth. It was a little too cumbersome to bring with us, but we got the silver medal for this particular firearm. And as the announcements went on, our name wasn't called, and our name wasn't called, and you know, you start to get a little bit nervous and think, oh no, well this just could be, a bust. But we were pleasantly surprised that we were able to bring home the first silver trophy for the Winchester Arms Collectors Association since they've been participating in the NRA Collectors Gun Show.
Wow. John, part of the thing that was wonderful about this exhibit and really knocked everybody's eyes out is just not the quality of the exhibit, but the theme, too, because it's the Winchester Junior Rifle Corps.
Yes, absolutely.
And this was a youth shooting program. The NRA had a NRA youth shooting program started about 1903.
Yes.
But then in the 19-teens, Winchester picked up with a concept.
Yes, they did. In 1917, Winchester decided to launch their own program. They did use the NRA program, the concept, to create their program. However, they went one leap, and I call it a giant leap. They went a giant leap further, and they allowed women, young girls, young girls to participate in the program. The NRA program at that time did exclude girls, and so it was great. In fact, the first member to sign up for the program was a girl. Her name was Ruth Russell. She was from New Haven, Connecticut.
That's very cool. Yeah. So, Jennifer, how did you come across this in its original box, even in the original shipping crate? What did you find on the shelf somewhere in a store?
Yes, no. It's just my husband and I both have been collecting together. We each collected singularly, believe it or not. I was collecting since about 1991, and he's been collecting since about 1981. And we met each other at the Ohio Gun Collector Show in 1996, ended up getting together in 1998, merged our collections, and to find this, we have traveled the country. We go to shows, Las Vegas, Tulsa, Oklahoma, Springfield, Massachusetts, and it was actually owned by a private collector who was deciding that, it was time to start letting some things go.
Wow. So original shipping crate, we don't have it here, but I'm wondering, we have to pack all this equipment and send it back to Virginia. Can I borrow the crate?
No. No.
Look, I had to ask.
She's pretty sure.
Yeah. Before we run out of time, how do we get more information about the NRA museums so you can go see some wonderful firearms like this?
They can come to the museums. It's always free of charge, open every day of the year except Christmas. There's one at NRA headquarters in Fairfax, Virginia, and one at the Bass Pro Shops in Springfield, Missouri, the NRA National Sporting Arms Museum. If they can't get by, they can see tens of thousands of photos of the fabulous guns in the museum at the NRAMuseums.com website.
Awesome.
You can follow us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and see all of our photographs from this weekend posted daily.
Wonderful. Thank you, folks, and thank you, Jennifer, for being here on Curator's Corner on NRA TV.
Welcome back. Thanks again for being a part of this edition of Cam and Company. We've got, coming up an hour from now, Dennis Santiago with Dennis Talks Guns, talking more about the Peruta case in California. We'll talk more about that at the top of the hour as well. Right now, I want to welcome from the Daily Caller on Twitter at Carrie Pickett. Carrie Pickett is with us. Carrie, how are you today?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. They're in the storied hallways of the U.S. Senate complex, right?
Yes, right off the floor of the Senate, where lots of things are being debated, including right now the health care bill. So you can only imagine all the things that are going on in the chamber right now.
Absolutely. Well, listen, I do appreciate you being with us there from Capitol Hill. You had a story over the weekend about this new lawsuit filed against, what, PayPal, Square, and Stripe, Gladwin Guns and Ammo, Blair Gladwin, the owner of this business, suing these huge companies. What's his complaint, Carrie?
Well, if we all notice here as gun owners, when you go to sites like online to buy a firearm, such as GunBroker.com, a lot of legal gun sellers will say, hey, you can't use PayPal, you can't use Square, you can only use your credit card because these particular transaction processors do not allow any sort of a transaction of firearms or firearm parts or receivers or whatever the case may be that has to do with firearms to be done over their services. So Gladwin Firearms decided to file a class action lawsuit on behalf of not just his company, but also other companies as well, under what is known as the UNRU Civil Rights Act. This is a particular act that is out in California, and what it says over in the act that all persons within the jurisdictions of the state of California are free and equal, no matter what their sex, race, color, religion, ancestry, national origin, and it goes on. And it's saying they are entitled to the full and equal accommodations, advantages, facilities, privileges, or services in all business establishments of every kind whatsoever. So I would imagine here that what they're looking at is like, look, we are a legal business, and we are entitled to having your business deal with us and not force us to go towards other businesses or doing workarounds. Very often we are seeing this in other places, such as what we saw with Operation Choke Point during the Obama administration, something else that's being worked on right now.
Absolutely. And this is something that, as you say, gun owners have run across this for years. Certainly, you talk with gun store owners, and many of them will tell you about their woes and their complaints. And it's interesting because this is not a Second Amendment challenge, right? This is challenging specifically, another statute entirely. Have you talked with anybody about any attorneys out there who've been able to take a look at this case to give you their opinion on what the prospects look like?
Right now, just very briefly with one of the press reps of this particular case. I'll be going deeper in with the attorney later on. What I do find fascinating, though, is that while this case is being filed at the same time, we're finding lawmakers up on the Hill looking to roll back the regulations of Operation Choke Point to basically have legal businesses, whether it's a firearms business, whether it's a payday lenders, whatever the case may be, say, look, if you're a legal business, you shouldn't be forced into cash-only transactions. You should be able to do your transactions with a bank, with a company like a PayPal, without being told to take a hike.
Talking again with Kerry Pickett of the Daily Caller. So the lawsuit requesting a public injunction requiring these companies to stop violating the UNRU Act, begin allowing firearms merchants to use their payment. And as you point out, PayPal, once owned by the staunch libertarian Peter Thiel, no longer owned by the staunch libertarian, I suppose, and the corporate policies reflect that.
Yeah. What's interesting is that here you have someone who is a big supporter of Second Amendment rights, who founded PayPal as a way for people, specifically at first Americans and then, of course, the entire world, to be able to have online transactions done very easily, to have businesses be able to do what they need to do to have their transactions done very easily. And then when he left the company, it ended up going into the hands of a political leftist who said that they were not interested in doing businesses with legal firearm dealers. And when I asked Peter Thiel about this last year at a Libertarian Freedom Fest convention, he ended up saying if I was still running PayPal, they wouldn't be doing that. So you can only imagine what he really thinks about his former company right now in terms of liberty, in terms of freedom, in terms of how it's being run right now.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Well, listen, Kerry, I do appreciate you joining us today. We'll let you get back to covering the Senate, but I look forward to talking to you again very soon with some updates.
Absolutely. Take care.
You too. Kerry Pickett joining us from the Daily Caller there on Capitol Hill today. Nicole Russell of the Federalist. Next hour, it's time to allow concealed carry permits in Washington, D.C. More on the Peruta case. A couple of the gun control groups have issued statements. We told you what Chris Cox and Ray Iley's executive director had to say earlier today. San Francisco, California, a press release from Americans for Responsible Solutions, the Law Center to Prevent Gun Violence, and the another at the Law Center. So two groups working so closely together, they might as well be one. Americans for Responsible Solutions says that they praise the decision by the U.S. Supreme Court to decline hearing Peruta versus California, a critical case that Americans for Responsible Solutions and the Law Center have been involved in since the very start. At issue, they say, a California statute that requires citizens to demonstrate good cause to be eligible for permits to carry hidden loaded weapons in public, an important policy on the books in several other states. In upholding the good cause requirement, a panel of 11 judges on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit recognized that the Second Amendment is not unlimited and that for centuries the Constitution has permitted government to impose strict guidelines on carrying concealed weapons in public. That's the statement from Americans for Responsible Solutions. Ignoring several things here. Ignoring the original Ninth Circuit decision that said, no, this is a violation. You can regulate the carrying of firearms, but you can't prohibit it. You got to have some way to carry, whether it's open or concealed. You got to have some way to carry because that's bearing arms. Completely didn't want to talk about that. Also didn't want to talk about the dissent from Justice Thomas today. You know, Justice Thomas says, listen, that was not the question before the court at the Ninth Circuit level. It wasn't whether or not California's concealed carry law is constitutional. The question is whether or not the residents of California have a right to bear arms. And is that right being violated by the California statutes right now, which ban the open carry of firearms, even unloaded firearms? And in San Diego County, that good cause requirement, self-defense, is not seen as a valid reason for good cause. Americans for Responsible Solutions completely sidesteps that today in their statement. Is self-defense good cause to carry a firearm? No, clearly, if they're praising this decision to Americans for Responsible Solutions, self-defense is not a valid reason for you to carry. Keep that in mind going forward. Robin Thomas, Executive Director of the Law Center to Prevent Gun Violence. Today's decision, a victory for smart gun laws and public safety. By leaving the Ninth Circuit's decision in Peruta undisturbed, the Supreme Court upholds the essentially unanimous view of the lower courts that a reasonable gun regulation, like the good cause rule, are in line with the Second Amendment. Essentially unanimous, except for the courts that have disagreed, such as the original Ninth Circuit panel in Peruta, the Seventh Circuit U.S. Court of Appeals out of Chicago. Anyway, yeah, essentially unanimous. Okay. Law enforcement officials, like the sheriff of San Diego County, she says, who was the original defendant in this case, are in the best position to determine how to safeguard their communities, and the court's decision not to hear the case leaves intact the sheriff's ability to do just that. So, you want to exercise your constitutional right? Just march on down to your local law enforcement office and get that permission slip. What are the rights? What are the rights do we do that for? Again, we still get, oh, you can even still call them a right. We won't even call it a privilege. You can pretend it's a right. We'll completely change the meaning of what a right is, but you can still call it a right. Just like they'll call what they're doing gun safety. Adam Skaggs, chief counsel at the Law Center to Prevent Gun Violence, says this is just the latest in a long line of court decisions rejecting gun lobby challenges to the smart gun laws. That's something different. That keep our families and communities safe. The court's refusal to take this case leaves in place the thorough, well-reasoned opinion from the Ninth Circuit, which found that requiring the concealed carry applicant show good cause before they're granted a permit to carry a hidden loaded weapon in public is very much constitutional. Every circuit court of appeals to consider the question has concluded that the reasonable gun regulations like San Diego's good cause rule do not infringe Second Amendment rights. Well, first of all, again, every circuit court of appeals case has not dealt with California's laws. And California's laws, as every Californian knows, are their own special animal. We have had court cases. Fourth Circuit has said that Maryland's concealed carry law, that's hunky-dory. There may issue. So, the Second Circuit basically said you have a right to carry that exists on paper, but really the government can override that right whenever it wants for basically whatever reason. Doesn't have to show that their policies would be effective in the slightest. Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, though, has said, no, you've got a right to carry. You've got a right to bear arms. If you've got a right to protect yourself in your home, well, it would make sense that you've got a right to protect yourself outside of the home, since we're talking about the same right of self-defense, and no other right stops at the door of your domicile, right? Your First Amendment rights extend beyond the home. Your Third Amendment, that's dealing with your house. Fourth Amendment, yeah, you still got a Fourth Amendment as soon as you step out your front door. Fifth, yeah, right on down the line, except for the Second Amendment and the right to keep and bear arms. All right, stick around. We've got more for you on the Peruta decision, or the non-decision from the Supreme Court. Hour 2 of Cam and Company, fueled by Hornady, is coming up next.
This is a very unique race here, the Bass Pro NRA 500 here in Bristol. Give you a little feel for Bristol. You go around it in about 15 and a half seconds. And you got 40 cars on a half-mile racetrack. It's really, really tight.
Even though it's a tight racing and rough racing, you got to be patient. You can't tear your car up too early. You got to be able to be around at the end.
Things happen so fast, and that's what makes it just an awesome place to be, because there's action all over the track for the fans to watch and see.
Our fans, you will not find a more patriotic sport than NASCAR. These fans love our freedom, our Second Amendment, our Constitution, our liberty. That's what this country was built on. That's the kind of people that our fans are, our drivers. And it just gives me great honor to be here.
What makes Bristol so special is this is the last great Coliseum. You can tell by when you first walk in this place, you look up and you're surrounded by fans. The track is so banked and you're right on top of the action.
I came to Bristol probably in 1969 for the first race. Probably had 10 to 15,000 seats in the grandstand. There's an old guardrail around it. People sat on the grass banks in the back of it. And it was asphalt. And today, the track holds 160,000 people. It's the last great Coliseum, I guess you would want to call it. It builds so much energy for the fans. It builds so much energy for the drivers and pit crews. So it has something very special about it. That's why they say it's Bristol, baby.
Things just happen quicker here. You know, you got to stay in the race to win the race.
It's real tight racing. It's bumper to bumper, and you got to move people to make things happen.
As a driver, I had a lot of fun. Some of my best finishes were here. You know, Austin Dillon and Ty Dillon are my grandsons, and they both race in NASCAR. As a car owner, I've had cars to finish 1, 2, 3, won the race, finish second, third. And we've also, as a car owner, loaded 3 of them on the rollback and took them home. So it can go either way. It's feast or famine at Bristol. Now I look back and think how it was on my daughter and my wife when I was driving. So I guess I'm getting payback for whatever you say.
I had to put myself in a good position, and it sucks for Ty. He had such a good run going, and the moves he was making were really impressive. And we just kind of let the race come to us. We had a good car all night, a third and fourth place car. And when it all said and done and everything played out, we were the car to win. So it was a bummer for him, but I'm glad we're able to go up that hill. I get to do a burnout on the way up. All the history that's taking place here and to be a part of it is special.
We'll take it any way we can get it. A lot of these fans here in Bristol, they were cheering loud over there in the front stretch and burning it down. And, hopefully we can do something like this come tomorrow night. Love this place, and I want to get as many fans as we can in here.
Watching NRA TV with Cam Edwards.
Welcome back. Hour two of Cam and Company, fueled by Hornady. It starts right now here on NRA TV, SiriusXM and Patriot 125. Nicole Russell of The Federalist joins us later in the hour, says it's time to allow concealed carry permits in Washington, D.C. Good thing that's not up to the Supreme Court. Dennis Santiago of Dennis Talks Guns talking about the Peruta case and the decision not to hear the Peruta case. We last hour told you about Chris Cox's reaction from NRA's Institute for Legislative Action. We shared with you Justice Clarence Thomas's written dissent, joined in that dissent by Neil Gorsuch. Now, a few months ago, we talked about the reaction from gun control advocates, Americans for Responsible Solutions, and the Law Center to Prevent Gun Violence. A few months ago, San Diego Union Tribune had a piece. This was back in May. William Gore had a piece. He's the sheriff there in San Diego County. And he wrote to talk about why this policy is such a great policy. He says, the case of Peruta versus California involved applicants who were issued licenses to obtain concealed carry permits because they failed to establish good cause, as required by California law. California's legislative branches clearly require that good cause be proved prior to the issuance of a license to carry a concealed firearm. He says, because the applicants believed that the Second Amendment gave them the right to possess a loaded handgun in public, they chose to seek redress in the judicial branch and sued over the denial of their applications. The good cause requirement, he says, is at the heart of the Peruta case. The sheriff's department has, since well before his time as sheriff, defined good cause as a set of circumstances that distinguishes the applicant from other members of the general public and causes him or her to be placed in harm's way. Now, keep in mind, that is not the definition of good cause held by every county sheriff in the state of California. In fact, there are many counties in the state of California, where self-defense is seen as good cause. You want to protect yourself? Okay, it's good enough reason for me. The most recent Sacramento County Sheriff's race, this was an issue in that race. And the current sheriff, the one who won election, has moved the county from a May issue to a shall issue system. And in the past couple of years, nearly 10,000 residents of Sacramento County have received their concealed carry license, whereas before you only had a couple of hundred because the sheriff didn't deem self-defense as a good enough reason to carry. Those numbers tell you the demand is there, regardless of what the sheriff thinks. There are thousands of residents in San Diego County who would be able to carry if they didn't live in San Diego County. Actually, there are millions who live in San Diego County who would be able to carry if they didn't live there. I would argue that there are tens of thousands who would apply if they thought that they could actually obtain a concealed carry license there in San Diego County. These are people whose rights are actively being denied right now. And again, there's a two-tier system in the state of California. There are some counties where self-defense is recognized. There are some counties where self-defense isn't. Sheriff Gore says the federal district court held that the San Diego County Sheriff's Department interpretation of good cause under California law was not unconstitutional and dismissed the applicant's case. Yes, but that leaves out a very, very important fact of that decision. The judge in that case said, listen, you don't really have a case, Mr. Peruta, because you can carry for self-defense. The judge said you can carry an unloaded firearm openly in California for self-defense. And if that law went away, then maybe you'd have a case, because then it would be about your ability to carry. But right now you can carry. So you got to go. And you know It's a funny thing. State of California then passed a ban on the open carry of unloaded firearms. Mm-hmm. And so that judge's reasoning was you have a right to carry for self-defense. But because you can carry an unloaded firearm openly, that satisfies that right of self-defense. Now, I would argue that it does not, but that judge at least recognized that the right to carry exists outside of the home. Sheriff Gore doesn't mention that. So the case is dismissed. He said the applicants then appealed to the 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals, where the state of California eventually stepped in to defend the constitutionality of its concealed carry law. Eventually. He skips right to the en banc review, the one that went his way. He doesn't mention at all the 3-judge panel that didn't go his way. He said, in issuing its decision, the 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals examined whether the Second Amendment protects the ability to carry concealed firearms in public. And again, that's not the issue. That wasn't the issue at the trial court level. That wasn't the issue at the 3-judge panel. Only when it got to this en banc review of the 9th Circuit did this become about the right to carry a concealed firearm in public, as opposed to the right to bear arms, which is that's the language of the Second Amendment. That's what the issue has always been about. And it's one of the reasons why Justice Thomas today, in his dissent, was kind of scathing, saying we really can't let the 9th Circuit get away with this. But they are. Sheriff Gore said, in issuing his decision, they looked at whether or not the Second Amendment protects the ability to carry concealed firearms in public. The court analyzed the history of the right to bear arms and came to the conclusion that the Second Amendment right to keep and bear arms does not include the right of a member of the general public to carry concealed firearms in public. It says, if the Supreme Court decides not to take the case, then the decision of the U.S. 9th Circuit Court of Appeals affirming the finding of the district court will stand. Uh-huh. The amendments, he says, to the Constitution enumerated in the Bill of Rights often stir the passions of persons on both sides of discussion regarding their meaning and scope, and rightfully so. He says the Bill of Rights sets forth many of the principles that make us a free and democratic society. For these reasons, I look forward to the final determination of the judicial branch on such an important issue. Notably missing in this piece is really any justification for how that good cause requirement is interpreted in San Diego County. Did you notice that? He says it's the heart of the Peruta case. And he says the sheriff's department has, since well before my time as sheriff, defined, quote, good cause as a set of circumstances that distinguishes the applicant from other members of the general public and causes him or her to be placed in harm's way. Okay, well, if that's at the heart of the case, why did he spend one sentence on that? This is, again, the basis for this lawsuit, the basis for his justification for the policy. What is it? Well, it's always been that way? I got to say, that doesn't sound very progressive of a Californian. Well, it's always been this way, so it's always got to be this way. No, it doesn't always have to be that way. And again, it is not that way uniformly throughout the state of California, which is something else that those who are cheering the Supreme Court decision today, that is an inconvenient truth for those individuals. Because in California, again, depending on where you live, you very much can get a concealed carry license. Self-defense is very much considered a good cause. Now, have those counties become apocalyptic wastelands? No. Don't believe so. Have the coastal counties in California, where concealed carry is not really allowed, concealed carry is allowed, but concealed carry licenses that are not issued, has crime disappeared in those coastal counties? No. Violent crime up for the past 3 years in a row in L.A. County. Gun-related crime up in San Francisco County. And again, keep in mind, because of the two-tiered system that's in place in California, if you live in one of these counties that says, yeah, self-defense, perfectly valid reason to get a concealed carry license, you can visit San Diego County. You can have dinner there. You can carry. You can go into San Francisco County as a concealed carry holder, even though San Francisco County, I don't think, has issued any concealed carry licenses. You can visit, and you can exercise your rights like residents of that city cannot. How about that? That and this, I guess, this is a praiseworthy, noteworthy system for the gun control advocates, like Americans for Responsible Solutions. I would think that they would still be kind of upset about that. That there exists a means for some people to lawfully carry in San Francisco. And think about that for a second. There are people, I assume, who are lawfully carrying in San Francisco today, visiting from other parts of the state. There are people, I assume, who are lawfully carrying in L.A. County today, visiting from other parts of the state. Do you ever hear about problems? Concealed carry holders from the more rural parts of California going to the big city and committing a bunch of carjackings and armed robberies. Do you ever hear stories about that? I never see that. I mean, like, that's not even a trope in Hollywood crime shows. Well, you know, I think it's because he was allowed to carry where he lives. It just doesn't happen. And you would not see an outbreak of violent crime in California were L.A. County or San Diego County or San Francisco County to actually recognize self-defense. Again, I think that one day it's coming. I do. Clearly, it's not going to be in the fall, unfortunately. But the arguments against concealed carry are so weak at this point that the only way that they can put up a fight is by doing what the court did today. And by doing, especially what the Ninth Circuit did on Bonk, to change the question. So it's not about your right to carry. It's not about your right to bear arms. Now it's about whether or not there's a constitutional right to carry a concealed handgun in public. And they can answer that question, knowing full well that wasn't the question that was asked. And then they can tell the plaintiffs, hey, you know what? You don't like that? Go file another case. Well, they've done that. There is the Peruta 2 case that's been filed. And eventually it'll get back up to a point where the Supreme Court can address it. And hopefully the makeup of the court at that point will be willing to actually address this question. But in the meantime, again, we have millions and millions of Americans and more every day obtaining their concealed carry license. That's not going to stop. The concealed carry licenses, the classes being held across the country right now, still full. Waiting lists in many places. So if you can't exercise your right, I would encourage you to do so. And in the meantime, if you live in a place where you've got a concealed carry law, you've got shall issue, or you've got constitutional carry, please don't forget. Please don't give up. Please don't turn your back on those millions of Americans who are living in places where their rights are being denied. I mean, what's the population of coastal California, New York City, New Jersey, Maryland, Hawaii, Washington, D.C., trying to think of the other few remaining may-issue states out there. How many tens of millions of people are we talking about here? Versus the hundreds of millions of Americans who live in a place where, yeah, the Second Amendment actually means what it says. We can't give up the fight. We can't simply say, well, you know, we lost there. And if you don't like it, I saw somebody on Twitter today say, well, you know, you can always move. Yeah, you can. You can, but I think it's a sad commentary when you have to move to another state in order to exercise a constitutionally protected right of all Americans. You think that's right? I understand federalism. I understand the federalism argument. Well, you know, again, the different solutions and not everything has to be controlled by the centralized state. I get it. I'm a fan of federalism. But here's why I'm not sure federalism applies here. Because federalism says, listen, you localities, you get to come up with whatever your inventive local solutions are to your local problems. And the answer is not always going to be the federal government. I have no problem with that whatsoever. That doesn't mean that you can violate the individual rights of Americans in the name of federalism. Never has that been what federalism is about. And this is exactly what we are talking about, the individual rights of Americans. And the Supreme Court and the Congress have over the hundreds of years of this country's existence determined that there are times when the federal government has to step in to protect those rights. Right? There are times where the states have said, listen, we've got to step in and protect the rights of the states against the federal government. There have been times where the federal government has stepped in and said, time out, we've got to protect the rights of the individual from you. And I would argue that this is one of those cases. I'm all for federalism, all for local solutions, but they can't violate individual rights, not even at the local level. And when we're talking about the right to keep and bear arms, that's our right. It doesn't matter if you live in Richmond, Virginia or Richmond, California. It's our right. And we're going to keep fighting until it's actually recognized as our right all across this country. All right, when we return, Nicole Russell joins us. She's got a piece of the Federalist. It's time to allow concealed carry permits in Washington, D.C. Another case in point. All right, stick around. Much more Cam and Company coming up right after this. Talking with Ron Sasaki from AmericanSnipers.org. In case people haven't ever heard of AmericanSnipers.org, what is the mission of this group?
Okay, what our mission is we help equip our military snipers. If they have any equipment needs when they're getting deployed, if they can't get equipment through their normal chain of command, they get a hold of us, and we gift that gear to them. No cost to them. We operate solely on donations. We're 100% nonprofit, all-volunteer organization. So we're just trying to help these guys out as they're going downrange.
And this is really, I think, a brotherhood that got started here. I mean, you've got a law enforcement, military members who were instrumental, I mean, in putting this together. This started with one guy helping one guy, and it kind of snowballed from there, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And it started, most of us have a law enforcement background. We're all current or former SWAT snipers. So in the early 2000s, we had some of our brother snipers getting deployed in various units, and they found out there was an equipment shortage at that time. So they asked for some gear, and it got donated, and then it just kind of snowballed from there. So we've been going strong ever since. You know, kind of slowed down with the units getting deployed over the last few years, but of course, things are starting to ramp back up again.
Absolutely. And you talk about the slowdown, but it never really disappears because, you know, a lot of these guys are they're kind of operating in the shadows. They're not operating in the theaters where we see a lot of headlines about combat. Some of these missions are taking place in places where we don't necessarily even think about guys being on the ground.
Yeah, absolutely. And because it hasn't been on the headlines, people kind of forget about them. And then, you know, so their budgets shrink, too. So we are still supporting some of those guys, even some of the, you know, the bigger units that are doing a lot of work overseas. So we've got a lot of equipment that's been going out. So, you know, all the donations and being able to be here at the NRA show has been great. That really helps out a lot.
That's fantastic. And just give me an example of like some of the type of equipment that you will provide these guys. What are they not getting?
Well, it's mostly sniper-specific equipment that we provide. So it's a lot of binoculars, range finders, spotting scopes, the Kestrel wind meters, a lot of those things that the guys ask for that they have a tough time getting through their normal chain of command. We operate solely on donations. So if you can go to AmericanSnipers.org, you can donate there, or you can buy some of our T-shirts and hats and challenge coins, and that's what helps us out.
I'm a mom, a business owner, and a patriot, but I am not a politician. A few years ago, I founded a nonprofit to defend voters' rights and stop election fraud. We exposed corruption, so the corruptors wanted me silenced. The IRS, FBI, ATF, OSHA, and a U.S. congressman turned my life upside down. Their investigations were invasive, abusive, relentless, and political. They demanded every social media message I'd ever posted, the name of every group I'd ever spoken to, and every word I spoke. I was supposed to give up, but I am not a victim. I'm an American, and I will not stand by and watch while our freedoms are picked off. An attack on one right is an attack on every right. So, I fight. I'm the National Rifle Association of America, and I'm freedom's safest place.
There are places only the hunter knows. Places where there is nowhere else. Where if you think of nothing, perhaps you will feel the ceaseless past begin to stir beneath your feet. and a chorus of voices whisper something you could never explain how you know. What it felt like the moment the mammoth appeared. The utter stillness of the battle. And the primal celebration that followed the kill. But maybe you don't need to explain it. Maybe it explains you. Trust the hunter in your blood.
Welcome back. It is Cam and Company. Coming to you once again from beautiful Farmville, Virginia. Later in the hour, Dennis Talks Guns joins us. Dennis Santiago talking about the Peruta decision. Right now, I want to welcome from the Federalist, Nicole Russell. Has got a piece, It's Time to Allow Concealed Carry Permits in Washington, D.C. Nicole, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Unfortunately, it sounds like at least there are five justices in Washington, D.C. who don't want to even allow concealed carry in California, much less D.C. This was a day of setbacks, but you say that the time has come in our nation's capital to actually recognize the right to bear arms.
Absolutely. I think in the wake of the shooting that happened at the Republican, at the baseball practice, even though that was in Alexandria, Virginia, I think it really kind of raised the alarm again for the importance of people who live in the District of Columbia, people who work there, particularly our representatives who walk around with very little protection. The time has come for them and for the rest of us who enjoy D.C. regularly to be able to protect ourselves in a place that's really just rampant with crime still and a place where our power is quite centralized.
All right, so I'm going to play devil's advocate here for a second. One of the common arguments that I've seen in opposition to your point of view is, are you really saying that Donald Trump would have been safer if there were a bunch of people carrying concealed at his inauguration, Nicole?
Absolutely. I mean, look, we all know, especially those of us who are super pro 2A, we all know that the more guns there are in the hands of sane, responsible adults, the safer people are. And this is not only statistically proven over and over again, but I've had these conversations with police officers. As I mentioned in my piece, I actually had this exact conversation with an officer on Capitol Hill who said that he thought things, the area he was serving and trying to protect would be safer if more people had guns legally and were able to carry them. Even if it's just for the simple fact that if you think you might commit a crime, you don't know if someone around you is legally carrying a weapon, so you might actually think twice about it.
What about the argument that D.C. is just a special place, Nicole? I mean, there are all these VIPs and foreign dignitaries and again, you know, members of Congress, the president. It's not safe, even with that, you know, the licensing. It's just there's just too much of a risk that some bad actor would do something to harm somebody important.
On the one hand, you're great at playing devil's advocate, Cam, by the way. I think on the one hand, yeah, of course, there are people who are not sane and who are not responsible. And people like us are not arguing for those folks to be able to get a concealed carry permit, and they likely wouldn't be able to. But I think for the exact reason you said, you know, D.C. is special, and there are all these special, important people here, that's the exact reason that we should be allowed to have it. Because there are so many people walking around. All of our representatives do not walk around with people, with security forces. They are trying to work, trying to serve with very little protection. Even just your average tourist in the place here, especially in summertime, I actually kind of avoid D.C. just because it is so packed with people. But when I am there with my children, I would like to know that I could protect myself and my family with that permit if needed be.
Yeah, because,
and it's sad it doesn't happen here in the very, you know, district.
You know, and I don't get into D.C. that often, but I'll be really honest with you, Nicole. That's one of the reasons. I mean, even when I lived in Northern Virginia and it was, you know, a 45-minute trip into the district, I rarely did I go. That was one of the reasons why, because why do that? Anything that I wanted to, you know, do, whether it was dinner or a movie or whatever, shopping, I could do that in Northern Virginia. I could still carry. And I remember there was one experience I had when I was in D.C. and I was walking to the metro and it was fairly late and I had my headphones on and I thought to myself, okay, well, this is stupid. Don't do that. And I took them off and there was somebody walking behind me and I realized that. And we eventually, you know, within a block or two got to a well-lit, well-populated place. But there was that moment of, oh, good God, is this really going to, I mean, like, it was like, almost like, is this really going to happen to me? Right?
Yes. No, that's absolutely true. I'm a little bit morbid, but, or just kind of a mama bear in me, but often I have been in DC with my kids and I've kind of played that scenario out. You know, when we're at a museum or especially if we're on the mall where there's very little cover, I thought to myself, what if something happened right here? This would be a perfect target for terrorism because of what DC represents. And what would I do? I would have no recourse but to hope that there were security forces nearby. And that's not guaranteed. And I think when you're in the district, you're close to the Capitol, you're trying to enjoy that area. Maybe even you're going to a meeting to chat with your representative or what have you. You should be able to feel safe. And I think, and of course, you know, there's like we just saw with the Supreme Court, it should be everywhere. We should be able to have concealed carry everywhere, but particularly in a place like D.C. where there is so much crime and there is so much tourism, and an attack there would be symbolically terrible.
You know, and let's not forget, because we've both, I think, been kind of talking about this from the perspective of people who don't actually live in the district, but you know, go in as tourists or workers. But you're right. Crime is bad in the District of Columbia with all of the gun laws that they have right now, Nicole. There are large sections of the city, particularly the east side of the city in southeast D.C. in particular, where violent crime is sky high. And it's not because they've got concealed carry. And the absence of concealed carry has not driven down the crime rate in the high crime neighborhoods of Washington, D.C. There are hundreds of thousands of people living in Washington, D.C. right now who could protect themselves with a firearm if they were legally allowed to do so outside of the home.
Sorry, I have a
3-year-old
twin.
That is okay. We are family friendly here.
I am not going to be able to answer your question.
All right, I tell you what, it's all right. The early warning siren is going off. We'll let you deal with that. I do appreciate you coming on the program. We'll have you back at some point during nap time, perhaps. Nicole Russell of the Federalist on Twitter at Russell_NM. See, there you go. Never a dull moment with kids around, but yes, there are people, obviously me selfishly, I would love to be able to have reciprocity with the District of Columbia. I'd love to be able to actually travel into the district instead of having to stop in Arlington or Alexandria, because I'm the same me. I got to tell you, I'm the same exact person. And frankly, violent crime is a lot lower in Northern Virginia anyway, so it's not that big a deal for me to stay out of D.C. But on occasion, it'd be nice to go into the district and not have to give up my right to carry. But again, there are hundreds of thousands. And how many thousands of D.C. residents are there who right now would apply for a concealed carry license if they could get one? You know, the law in D.C. theoretically allows you to get a concealed carry license. It's much like California's, much like the law as it's interpreted in San Diego County. Got to show good cause, self-defense not seen as a valid reason. Got to show a specific ongoing threat against your life. If you do not demonstrate that specific ongoing threat against your life, then you will not receive a concealed carry license. And once that specific ongoing threat against your life has disappeared, so does your concealed carry license. At least when it expires, you're not going to be able to renew it. How many good people in bad neighborhoods in D.C. right now can't legally carry a firearm? because the local officials there have decided that self-defense outside of the home really isn't a part of the right to keep and to bear arms. You know, I mentioned earlier the split in the circuit courts around the country in the Seventh Circuit Court, which has said, yes, it is a real right. You got to treat it as such. That was in a case challenging the ban on carrying in the state of Illinois. It was just an outright ban. You couldn't open carry, you couldn't conceal carry, couldn't carry. And that was challenged. And it got to the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals. And the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals said, yeah, you've got a right. In fact, it makes more sense for you to have a right to protect yourself out on the street where you are more likely to be the victim of a violent crime than in your, for example, 37th story apartment in Chicago. Once you're up there, once you're behind the security door and you're up the elevator and the doorman's down there and the door's locked for entry, yeah, you're pretty safe. You're safer than you're going to be out on the street. And if the purpose of the right to keep and bear arms is self-defense, then why wouldn't it extend to the place where you're more at risk? So the politicians in Illinois, the anti-gun politicians in Illinois, they had a choice to make. They could appeal this up to the Supreme Court, but they were scared. They were nervous. I mean, the ban on handguns that had been struck down in the Heller case out of D.C. and then the McDonald case out of Chicago had them really, really worried that an outright ban on carrying was going to get struck down. They thought, you know what, maybe when it comes to like California's laws or New York's laws, when it's theoretically possible to get a concealed carry license, but practically speaking, impossible, maybe the courts are going to go along with that. And some courts have. They were wise, but they were scared that this case in particular out of Illinois was going to establish once and for all a right to carry the Supreme Court. So they decided not to appeal that case. They decided as much as they didn't like the decision from the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, they would live with it because they didn't want the court to actually say, yep, you're right, Seventh Circuit. There is a right to carry. They were scared. And so they worked on a shall issue law that ultimately was adopted in the state of Illinois. And Illinois became the last state in the union to put on its books a law dealing with the right to carry in some form or fashion. Again, the vast majority of states recognize this as a right. There are a handful of states out there that dole this out as a privilege. And when just a few years ago, the gun control advocates had the opportunity to present a clear case on this to the Supreme Court, they didn't. Again, that tells me they're not confident in their position. And right now, you've got justices that are contorting themselves into pretzels, trying to come up with the logic to justify looking at the text of the Second Amendment. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. To look at that and determine that somehow the right to keep and bear arms ends at your front door. There really isn't a good argument for this, legally speaking. There isn't a good argument for this, commonsensically speaking. But even legally, I think what they're doing right now is just engaging in delaying tactics, trying to drag this out as long as possible. Because we've seen that too, haven't we? Go back to Chicago. After the handgun ban was struck down, it's not like the city of Chicago said, all right, this is really embarrassing that we've been violating people's constitutional rights for so long. We feel terrible about this. We're going to change course. We're actually going to recognize the right to keep barrels as a right. Mm-mm. No, they said, we think the court got it wrong. We're going to continue to think the court got it wrong. We're going to continue to do everything we can do to make it as hard as possible for you to exercise your right. No ranges, no gun stores. That was their first set of laws. Taken to court, lost, changed their policy. Okay, you can have ranges and gun stores here in these places of the city that don't really exist. Taken to court, lost again. Now they're rewriting their laws for the third time. And I'm not convinced that they're not going to go end up back in court before all is said and done. Because there is no real recognition that this is a right. They are fighting this as hard as they can. I think, again, delaying the inevitable, given the real march in support of the Second Amendment that we have seen from coast to coast over the past 30 years, that we continue to see, I think they are fighting a long-term losing effort. But, man, they're intent on dragging this out as long as they possibly can. All right, when we come back, Dennis Santiago joins us from Dennis Talks Guns. We're going to talk more about the Peruta case, hear from a Californian himself about the Peruta case and what the future holds for the right to keep and bear arms in California. Stick around. We'll be back with much more Cam and Company coming up right after this.
We're back here at the NRA annual meeting in Atlanta. John Pop here with Jim Sapieca and Phil Schreier from the NRA Museums. I love these special curator's corners we get to hear do here during annual meeting. And we have a guest. Tell us, gentlemen, who is joining us now?
Now we have Wayne Elliott representing the Kentucky Rifle Association, and they brought a spectacular display, all the work of a single gunsmith from right here in Georgia, correct?
That's correct.
Wow, beautiful. Wayne, why don't you tell us a little bit about what we have here?
Well, we were particularly glad as an association to bring this to represent the state of Georgia for the NRA show here in Atlanta. This is made by both the rifle and the pistol made by Georgia's premier gunsmith during the period. The rifle was made about 1820, 1825. The pistol, perhaps about 1830.
These were both done by Wiley Higgins.
Wiley Grover Higgins, who was born in 1799 in South Carolina and was in Georgia in the Indian Springs area when it was still a Creek Indian capital.
Now, this is the earliest known attributed rifle made in Georgia.
There's one earlier by a gunsmith named Richard Allen, made perhaps 10 years earlier than this.
Wow.
Now this is about 1820?
1820, 1825.
And the pistol, a single shot, we see it in its percussion form as opposed to the flintlock, but that was originally flintlock.
Yes, we can tell from the lock plate that's on it that it was originally flintlock. And it was converted to percussion probably by the gunsmith Wiley Higgins himself.
So, Phil, tell us that term Kentucky rifle. We're talking about a rifle that was made in Georgia. So,
well, you know, it's one of those button issues with me.
I know. Why do you think I said it?
Yeah, American long rifles. It applies to everybody. It doesn't have any sectional bias
right
to it. So, you know, a beautiful American long rifle and pistol, and they 1820, 1830. I think, although we see a lot of brass, a few coin silver and silver inlays, there's more silver to go with these today than there was yesterday. Tell us about that.
Well, the pistol itself is actually silver mounted because the gunsmith was not only, well, the maker was not only a gunsmith but a silversmith as well. Both of these won silver medals at the NRA convention. So
there you go.
We're very pleased with that.
How appropriate. Silver takes the silver.
Yeah. Silver takes the silver.
And the rifle has the classic American long rifle features. It has the very long barrel. Mm-hmm. It's a slightly smaller caliber, which was originated to save lead in the colonies and in the new United States where lead was a scarce premium. It has the beautiful inlay and ornate patchwork. These are really works of art, in addition to being the first indigenous American firearm.
And you're right, Jim. These really are works of art. I mean, they're beautiful, functional in their day, and beautiful. And also, technology-wise, that long rifle really got the job done, right?
Yeah, it did. It was exactly what was needed for hunting in the Eastern America. And this particular gunsmith had distinctive features that are very unique to him. The paneled butt plate on the rifle, the sculpting of that. And then the silver inlay, him being a silver smith,
yes. Mm-hmm.
Silversmith, you see the silver inlay around both of the locks, behind the locks, an unnecessary but decorative and beautiful touch.
Yes, and I appreciate your pointing out that it really is artwork applied to the rifle and the pistol, which were necessary tools of the day. But here you have not only a great craftsman, but an artist really expressing himself in this media.
Yeah.
Beautiful stuff. All right. How do we get more information about the NRA museums? Because there's lots of beautiful pieces of art in there, too, gentlemen. Tell us how we can do that.
Well, we have a number of fantastic American long rifles and pistols on display in all of our museums. The flagship National Firearms Museum in Fairfax, Virginia. The NRA's National Sporting Arms Museum in Springfield, Missouri, at the flagship store of Bass Pro. And also out at the Frank Brownell Museum in the Southwest in Raton, New Mexico. You can visit all of our museums, open 7 days a week, free admission. Plenty of free parking as well. And if you can't visit us off the interstate, come by and visit us on the internet at nramuseums.org. And we've also got Facebook and Instagram and
everything else.
A whole potpourri of social media.
Wayne, gentlemen, thanks for being on Curator's Corner on NRA TV.
Your first source for Second Amendment news and information. It is Cam McCumbin here on NRA TV, Sirius XM Patriot 125 and more. Top of the hour, today's hero of the day, deal of the day, good guy. Also coming up in hour three, we'll talk with two attorneys. Tim Lee with the Center for Individual Freedom joins for the Liberty Update. Our friend Kurt Schlichter from Town Hall joins us talking about the Peruta case. And we're going to talk more about the Peruta case right now with Dennis Santiago from Dennis Talks Guns. Dennis, how are you, sir?
Oh, I'm doing okay, Cam. Greetings from behind enemy lines.
Yes, the beaded curtain that is descending across the Pacific states, as I said over the weekend on Twitter. It is a sad, sad place behind the beaded curtain. Dennis, you got some weird rights that some folks don't think are rights at all. You've got a right to, you know, all kinds of goods and services, but the right of self-defense, not so much, it seems.
Well, you know, these days it's the right of the state to tell you what to do is what's paramount in terms of what's happening in California. And they're getting more and more curmudgeon-y about it.
Yeah, they are, yes. I mean, you can look at the legislation that is coming down the pike here. You've got a one gun a month for long guns in California, which is advancing. July the 1st, your magazine ban goes into effect. No longer will Californians who right now legally possess magazines that can hold more than 10 rounds, July the 1st, they will not be allowed to possess the very things that they can hold in their hand right now, will not be allowed to keep them, or they will be in violation of the law. And I will ask you, Dennis, do you feel and do you fear that some California cities and some California lawmakers are going to be emboldened by the Supreme Court's decision not to hear the Peruta case today?
I mean, you know, they're pretty bold as it is. Nothing's going to stop the emboldenment. There are a number of additional laws that they wish to pass this year that are coming down the pike. It's really out of control. They have a supermajority in the state. They are exploiting that supermajority in any and every form that they can. It's not just guns. It's pretty much everything else. Nanny has gotten a hold of a switch, and she's starting to slap hands.
Yeah. Well, you're getting a little out of line, Dennis, you know, thinking you've got a right to protect yourself with a firearm outside of the home and all. I mean, what else is Big Nanny going to do besides start to slap some hands? Did you take a look at Justice Thomas's written dissent today?
Yes, I did. And I agree with Justice Thomas that on the particular subject of gun rights and carrying outside the home, that California and states like it are now in a position where they have a very, very different view of how things are happening in other states. And, you know, bearing in mind that this aspect of gun law is something that is run in this country a lot closer to how alcohol law is done. It's done state by state. And there's no federal alignment of all these things yet. I don't know that there is any real case to be made yet for federal alignment, some law coming from that side of the world that forces all these things to all line up. That's probably something that has to wait until reciprocity is passed. And at that point, you're going to start to see a difference between federal interpretation and state interpretation. If you look at the Supreme Court and what they've done in recent years, they've essentially kind of tried to let things go at the state-by-state level as much as they could until there was a real compelling need to change it to a Fed thing. And, in the end, there are still additional cases like this coming down the way, and sooner or later one of them's going to hit.
So let me ask you a practical question about California law. Most of the counties in California are actually, they recognize self-defense as a valid reason to issue a license, right? When you get into the coastal areas, that's where you get into the, we're not going to recognize self-defense as a right. But let's say somebody lives in Sacramento County and they've got their concealed carry license. They can drive into Marin County, right? That license is good for the entire state of California, correct?
Yes, that is entirely correct. If you have a concealed weapons permit in any county in California, and it's done county by county, that permit is valid anywhere in the state of California. So if you're out in Palmdale, which is a town not too far from L.A. or that part of the world, and you have a permit from that area, you can drive right into downtown Los Angeles and be perfectly legal. This particular argument over who can do what is purely based on the preferences of local jurisdictions and how they feel about what happens to their citizens in their areas. Strangely enough, it also happens to be the areas where crime is going up.
Yeah, we should probably talk about that a little bit, Dennis, because, L.A. County, 3 years running, you've got an increase in violent crime. San Francisco, violent crime is up. And these are places, again, that are sort of just leading the charge when it comes to gun control, not just when it comes to restricting the right to carry, but, you had local ordinances in L.A., regarding the magazine ban before the state law went into effect. I mean, you've got local officials who are sort of building their name and reputation on gun control proposals.
Oh, yeah. It's a way to get elected, right? And actually, more important than that, let me clarify that. It's a way to get campaign donations to come into your coffers from the people that would like you to cooperate with them and their agendas. Strangely enough, several of them are not from California. But, what the heck? In regards to what happens in places like L.A. or San Francisco, this really is an agenda that's being set by the inner city needs. Strangely enough, it's also being set in the face of a massive increase in the release of prisoners from prisons that is happening in California, which is basically just raising the danger levels. And, oh, by the way, none of those people care about these law-abiding laws. They just do what they want. And the rest of us, I've seen reports from sociologists that basically are saying, hey, it's a little bit more dangerous, but you'll get used to it. Oh, come on.
And the sad thing is you shouldn't have to get used to this. I mean, again, in most of the state of California, it's not difficult. Self-defense is a valid reason to get a concealed carry license. But there are about 12 million people, I think, in places like L.A. County, San Francisco, Alameda, the dozen or so counties in the state of California where it's very restrictive or impossible to get a concealed carry license. If there are 12 million people who are simply ineligible to get a license, I mean, Dennis, think about how many people would get one if that were allowed. We're talking, somewhere between, if you talk about 5 to 10% of the population, you're looking at 600,000 people to over a million residents in California who would obtain a concealed carry license if they could. They're legally eligible. They just can't show, quote, good cause.
Or extraordinarily good cause is what the sheriff of San Diego applies. So there's no reason to think that the CCW uptake rate in these areas will be any different from any other place in the country. There's a lot of evidence that shows that exactly what those percentages are. It's now fairly common in many areas of the United States. The effect of it is also very common and well understood. There's been many years to observe the fact that, you know, the world doesn't come apart when you have a lot of people going around with individual CCWs. As a matter of fact, you know, you get a few more crime stops that occur out in public. You don't get that many more because those kinds of things are not really as common as people think. But in comparison to, say, shopkeeper shootings in defense, you know, that's a fairly common thing in this country. And it's also a very common thing in California. A lot of shopkeepers repel borders and homeowners repel borders in the state. And at pretty much the same rates with about the same effect as they do in the rest of the country. So what California is doing is trying to find a way to go against what the statistics say. And that just does not make any sense. It doesn't make any sense to me. I mean, I'm a math guy, and I don't think it makes any sense to them either. But, you know, they probably took Common Core. I'm sorry.
Speaking again with Dennis Santiago on Twitter, at Dennis Santiago, about the Peruta decision. And I imagine, I don't know when the last time you were at the gun store or the range, Dennis, but I imagine that this is going to be the topic of conversation, you know, at the range this week. And I'm curious if you'll run into folks who say, listen, it's time for me to get out of here. I'm moving to Arizona. I'm moving to Nevada. I'm moving to someplace with saner gun laws. And what would you tell somebody who said, listen, Dennis, you know, let the last gun owner turn out the lights on California, but I'm gone.
Well, a lot of people have. A lot of people have left. And this kind of stuff is it's a very common topic at ranges. It wasn't this weekend because, you know, I was this weekend I was getting ready. It's high power weekend. I'm getting ready to go to Camp Perry and shoot at the Nationals. So that's a little bit more focused than normal side conversation. But people,
I can understand that.
People have been leaving in droves. And, you know, the bottom line is we're at the point where we're starting to run short of people to keep fighting. A lot of the energy has left the state, and that's left us at a tremendous political disadvantage here. There are a few people like me and several others, you know, we're not going to abandon this place because we still consider this to be an important part of the United States of America. But, yeah, we're getting few and far between here.
Absolutely. Well, listen, we're not going to give up the fight. I appreciate all that you do. And you know, I've heard this. I think it was Scott Bach, who's the head of the Association of New Jersey Rifle and Pistol Clubs, told me years ago, you know, I'm not going to tell anybody to stay someplace if they got an opportunity to go somewhere and live in greater freedom. But don't forget the people you live behind, right? And keep fighting for them. If it's, you know, keeping up your membership in the California Rifle and Pistol Association, if it's contributing to, you know, lawsuits like the Peruta case, but stay active when you're able to leave a state with really restrictive gun laws and get to live in freedom. Because there are some folks who can't do it for financial reasons, can't do it for employment reasons, family reasons. Not everybody can simply, you know, move across the border to Arizona or even move to a county in California where a sheriff actually recognizes your rights.
That's true. And here's the probably the most important reason. California is a testing ground for these kinds of laws. They win here. They'll replicate it everywhere else. We've already seen that they do that. This is gun control 101 classroom territory. The rest of the country, you know, you can laugh at what happens here and the hapless plight of people that you know, just are running out of steam to fight. But the bottom line is you got to remember, this is where they learn what they're going to try everywhere else. And that is a very dangerous thing to just let pass.
Yep, you're absolutely right again. Dennis, I do appreciate you joining us on the program, sir. Have fun at Camp Perry.
Oh, I will. That is, it is my joy to go out there. It is just the most wonderful thing to be out there competing, doing well, making a mistake, and going to ice cream at the end of the day to talk about how everybody else can say, yeah, I made that mistake too, and it's fun. It is great. If you ever get to go to the Nationals or shoot the Nationals, take it. It is one of the most clubby and wonderful parts of the sport that we participate in.
I second that emotion. Dennis Santiago from Dennis Tox Guns, again on Twitter, at Dennis Santiago. Join us here on Cam and Company. Thanks, Dennis. We'll talk again soon.
Take care, man.
And by the way, when Dennis says clubby, he doesn't mean like you've got to be in the in club. No, the shooting sports, first of all, overall, I think are incredibly welcoming. But the national matches, you know, we've had the opportunity to be out there for the national matches on a couple of occasions. And it's 6 weeks. It's all summer long. You've got different disciplines that are coming in over the course of the 6 weeks or so. Volunteers, you've got folks who are second, third, fourth generation volunteers now. You've got people who are competing, you know, for 50 years straight. You've got fathers and sons and grandsons and now daughters and granddaughters that make this their family vacation each and every year. It truly is something special, but it's not an insular community. They love welcoming folks into the fold. All right, stick around. Hour three of Cam and Company, fueled by Hornady. It's on the way right after this.
What this program will do is it will take you from somebody who has a gun and might have a gun on your hip to somebody who is proficient in using that gun.
I would say I'm still in the beginner's phase in a sense that I didn't really start doing any official training, going to classes, until about a year ago.
If I were to put it on a scale of 1 to 10 as far as proficiency, I would say I'm under 5. That will change because I have made that decision to become as proficient as possible.
With a handgun, I've got a lot more experience, so I'm a little bit better shot. With a rifle, Caitlin is a better shot because of all the experience she has had.
I've been fortunate enough to do a lot of shooting and be in units that have done a lot of shooting. So when it comes to the legality of it, the responsibility of it, and when it comes to the actual physical training, I think it's awesome.
I have a lot of experience with firearms, but from high-level instructors, they just have infinite knowledge, and it's really nice to learn from people like them.
You know, I've done some classes before, but these guys really break it down into every little step so that you're able to really hone in every little movement.
They all have similar backgrounds, but the diversity in each of them and the stories and experiences they've all had are ideal for someone like myself to walk into this experience.
Oh my gosh, it's definitely a once-in-a-lifetime experience getting training from these amazing guys out here. Gotten so much more out of this than a couple weeks of shooting on my own.
There's things that I've done that are fast. There's things I've done that look good. There's things I've done that work in certain scenarios. These guys are teaching a way that works every time. The heavy burden that you carrying was where I learned the most.
The right responsibilities is probably one of the more important parts of what you can learn.
On the range and off the range, you know, just knowing what the laws are, how we need to think, the mindset that we need if you are carrying a gun, that it is a big responsibility.
A lot of that information was eye-opening to me, and I hadn't heard it instructed that way, I hadn't heard it presented that way, so it was very educational.
You can always go to the range and shoot at paper, but this class brought in different elements that you don't always do, like low light shooting.
Statistically, things happen mostly after dark when you would need to use your firearm, and so that's a really important skill that I need to have.
With Airsoft, it really helped wrap the whole training experience together, brought the adrenaline level up, the realness of the scenario.
I think it's the best way to learn. I think you can tell somebody something so many times, and you can look at it on paper so many times, but until you get that real tactile response and that adrenaline and that situational scenario, there's no better way to learn.
When the whistle hit and Derek started running, when I pulled out my gun out of my holster and shot, you could see the distance that he got on me, and that's such a huge reality check.
So as parents, this class is really great. The more tools that we have, you know, to protect our kids and our family, I think the better.
This program is great for everyone. I think it's great for someone like me that's carried a long time and had a lot of shooting experience. And I think it's great for someone that's coming in, and this may be the only class they take.
Made in America since 1949. Family owned and operated. Legendary performance. This is Hornady.
You're watching NRA TV with Cam Edwards.
Welcome back. Hour three of Cam and Company starts right now, fueled by Hornady on the program this hour. Tim Lee with the Center for Individual Freedom. Kurt Schlichter from Town Hall. It is it's actually a beautiful day for like the next 3 days in Central Virginia. It's going to be nice. It's going to be like around 80, humidity not nearly what it has been. So the critters on the farm are loving it right now, particularly the bunny rabbits. I've seen an awful lot of bunnies around. Now, join us on the program, as I mentioned, Tim Lee, Kurt Schlichter going to join us later on in the hour. Let's get to today's hero of the day, our deal of the day, and our good guy. Hero of the day from AL.com in Alabama. A homeowner shot three suspects during an attempted home invasion in Theodore, Alabama, on Thursday afternoon. The Mobile County Sheriff's Office said a 62-year-old U.S. Marine Corps veteran shot the suspects as they were trying to get into his home on Thomas Road. According to authorities, the suspects had broken into the man's home before and threatened to harm the victim if he reported the incident to authorities. Snitches get stitches. Homeowner did report the first incident. And apparently the suspects decided, well, you know what, we told this guy, don't say anything to anybody, or we'll be back. And since he reported it to somebody, they went back. When the suspects returned to the residence on Thursday, they fired several rounds through the front door. The victim hit in the shoulder. Authorities said the victim returned fire, injuring all three suspects. Deputies say two of the suspects drove away from the victim's home, made it to a Dollar General store. Deputies arrived at the store to find the two suspects on the ground. The victim, as well as the suspects, transported to local hospital. Suspects are in custody. They'll be booked into the Mobile County Metro Jail when released. The homeowner, hopefully, is going to be okay. We'll try to get you more information on this 62-year-old veteran of the U.S. Marine Corps who defended himself in his home. Now, again, I don't know about you, but I kind of think that if these three punks had decided to target the 62-year-old man out on the sidewalk in front of his home, I still think the 62-year-old had the right to protect and defend himself with a firearm. Don't know about you, but again, your right to self-defense does not disappear. Your need for self-defense does not disappear when you leave your front door. All right, our deals of the day today. Yeah, two of them. Sorry. First, from New Haven, Connecticut. This is sort of your garden variety deal of the day. I included this because this is typically what happens when somebody gets caught, violent crimes committed, illegal gun possession. And this, by the way, in Connecticut, where 4 years ago they passed all kinds of new gun control laws that were supposedly going to cut down on these types of incidents occurring. It is not, but the punishment for these types of incidents, still extraordinarily light. 34-year-old Edward Fulton sentenced to 36 months in prison, followed by 3 years of supervised release for illegally possessing a firearm. Now, it wasn't just that Mr. Fulton illegally possessed said firearm. He pointed at that firearm at a group of people outside of a nightclub last March. It was March the 12th, 2016. A New Haven police detective who was working an extra duty assignment at a nightclub saw Fulton outside the club, pointing a handgun at a group of people. The detective drew his revolver, ordered Fulton to drop the weapon. Fulton instead put it in his sweatshirt and kept walking. The detective ordered Fulton to stop. He eventually complied. The handgun was seized. Described as a 9mm Derringer that was cocked and loaded with two rounds of ammunition, it had been reported stolen in New Haven, Connecticut a year previously. So guy points a gun at people. He's not allowed to possess the firearm because he's a felon in possession of said firearm. But he only pleads guilty to illegal possession of the firearm. He's got a lengthy criminal history, according to the Bridgeport News, that includes multiple felony convictions for robbery and firearm offenses. So this is not his first time. He's got multiple felonies involving guns and robberies. And he gets 36 months behind bars, 3 years. Now, the good credit system in Connecticut is a convoluted nightmare. I won't try to explain it to you. It would take up the rest of the hour. Let's just say there's a pretty good chance if this guy keeps his nose clean behind bars that he'll get 5 months or 5 days a month knocked off of his sentence. Every month that he serves, it's another 5 days knocked off. So chances are the three-year sentence is going to be around 2.5, maybe a little bit longer. 2.5 years for being a convicted felon in possession of a firearm, pointing that loaded gun at a group of people on the street. 2.5 years. If this guy had been charged in federal court simply with being a felon in possession of a firearm, he would have been looking at 10 years behind bars and having to serve 85% of that sentence before he was eligible for early release. I thought, again, Connecticut had all of these great gun control laws that are going to cut down on violent crime. So how is it that a career criminal is out there committing crimes with firearms and still going to slap on the wrist? That's deal of the day number one. Deal of the day number two. From Louisiana, Plaquemine Parish, the Post-South newspaper. Dan Kopp reporting from Houma, Louisiana. A 25-year-old Terrebonne High School basketball standout was murdered over the weekend in Gonzales, Louisiana. According to the Ascension Parish Sheriff's Office, Jared Brown transported to a hospital just after 1 a.m. on Saturday after suffering multiple gunshot wounds. He was later pronounced dead. He had attended a house party where most of the attendees had arrived by a party bus from LaForge, Terrebonne, and Assumption Parishes. Brown got into an argument with a female at the party. The woman's brother, identified as 19-year-old Joshua Harris of Thibodeau, pulled out two guns and fatally shot Brown. Harris then fled the scene. He was arrested about 8 o'clock this morning in Thibodeau by the Thibodeau Police Department, transported to the Assumption Parish Jail, now facing charges of second-degree murder, illegal discharge of a weapon, possession of a firearm by a convicted felon. More charges may be pending, and the case is still under investigation. The 19-year-old Joshua Harris has a long criminal history with charges such as attempted second-degree murder, armed robbery, aggravated second-degree battery, simple robbery, and even an obscenity charge. He's 19. Now, some of these charges may have been dropped, and I'm trying to figure out what this guy's exact criminal history looks like. How it is that he's 19, has faced so many charges, is still out on the street. He is, according to deputies, on probation until July of 2021. So for at least some of those crimes, he received something that was called punishment. And it looks like the something that was called punishment amounts to, in essence, probation. Because here's a 19-year-old who's already managed to rack up a pretty long rap sheet. And let's hope he's not just getting started, because now second-degree murder and other charges added to his history. He is today's second deal of the day. On to our good guy. From Atlanta, Georgia, DeKalb County, WSB, Channel 2 in Atlanta. Story out of Dunwoody, Georgia. Officer Jeffrey Leach with the Dunwoody Police Department stopped an SUV, noticed that there was a kid riding in the car who was on the car seat. starts talking to the driver of the car, finds out the driver of the car doesn't have a car seat for his youngest child. Doesn't have the money for a car seat for his youngest child. On Facebook, the Dunwoody Police Department said rather than just issue a citation, Officer Leach used the stop as a teaching moment. He offered the driver a chance to follow him to Target to buy a car seat. He said Leach is one of our car seat installation technicians, so he knows a thing or two about child car seats and their installation. Driver happily agreed to share his story. Officer Leach helped the driver pick out the perfect seat and installed it. Department said we're super proud of Officer Leach for exercising a little compassion and helping keep our Dunwoody streets safe. Well, there you go. Again, one of those simple acts of kindnesses, but is the ticket or the citation going to lead to the desired result, or can we maybe get there in a different way? Oh, if only the gun control advocates would be so open-minded. All right, coming up a little bit later on in the hour, Mr. Tim Lee joins us from the Center for Individual Freedom. I also mentioned our friend Kurt Schlichter at Town Hall will join us on the program. But before we take a timeout, a couple of other stories to get to. Talking about our hero of the day, you know, in Australia right now, they're getting ready to, well, they're in the early days of this amnesty where if you illegally possess a gun, you can just turn it in. And nobody really, what's fascinating is nobody really seems to think this is going to work to lower the violent crime rate in Australia, which is creeping back up. You got people who are complaining, you know, the garbage guns are going to get turned in. Legal gunners are going to turn in their guns. Even government officials are saying that they're encouraging people to turn over their heirlooms as opposed to actually going after the violent criminals. Turn in grandpa's gun. Go ahead. Get rid of it. We want to destroy it. In the meantime, as I mentioned, violent crime is becoming a growing concern in Australia. And there was a fascinating column in the Herald Sun by Andrew Bolt yesterday. He I'll quote the original author because he was just Andrew Bolt was talking about another columnist named Andrew Rule for the Herald Sun, who wrote a column about the weasel words being used by local police in describing an attempted carjacking. The Mortlock Chelsea Leader newspaper reported that three men with iron bars, quote, attempted to hijack a car on June the 4th. The news item said one man opened the driver's door while the others bashed the car, but they fled after one of the passengers challenged them. Columnist Andrew Rule says it's funny that happened. Who was in the car that could scare men armed with iron bars? You got three guys with, you know, iron pipes. Who got out of that car? Well, according to Andrew Rule's sources, there was a woman who got out of the car. It was an off-duty police officer who got out of the car. And this off-duty police officer drew her pistol. Yeah. Carrying a firearm for self-defense in Australia, again, it's just not, it's not a thing. It's not done. Only a very select few Australians would ever be in a position to defend themselves with a firearm against an attempted carjacking like that. But thankfully she was. Imagine if this had not been a police officer who legally possessed that firearm, who could use that firearm in self-defense. And there are some Australians who are, in fact, thinking quite a bit about that. Andrew Rule, though, wonders why the incident was reported so vaguely and ignored by senior police, supposing they knew about it. Why so publicity shy, he wonders. Perhaps, he says, it's not a good look to admit suburban streets are so unsafe that carjackers and muggers can brazenly bail up police as well as ordinary citizens. Better to mislead the public than alarm anyone. Andrew Bolt for the Herald Sun newspaper says, Rule also points out criminals now seem to have no trouble arming themselves, and rates of violent crime are now frighteningly high. If the law-abiding were also armed, maybe they'd feel more able themselves to drive off crooks. Yeah, maybe so. But again, right now in Australia, not many people have that right. And those who speak up, those who would say, you know what, maybe we should think about this. Violent crime is going up. Criminals don't seem to have any trouble getting a hold of guns illegally here in Australia, despite our restrictive gun control laws, despite the fact that we are an island nation. They seem to be smuggled into this country, if nothing else. So, yeah, you know, maybe we've got a right to defend ourselves and protect ourselves. You're kind of a kook if you start talking like that. That's just not done. It's just not done. Now, I think it's even kookier to stand by while violent crime rises. I think it's kind of kooky to say that if you're an off-duty police officer, you can protect yourself with a firearm, but otherwise you're just flat out of luck. I think that's really kooky. And who knows? Maybe we're starting to see some whispers. Just whispers, not shouts yet, but some whispers about the right to bear arms down under. When we return here on this edition of Cam and Company, Tim Lee with the Center for Individual Freedom will be with us. Kurt Schlichter from Town Hall later in the hour as well. Stick around. Got to take a quick break, but we'll be back with more right after this.
So what can the public do to help Hero Hunting?
The biggest thing right now, obviously, is financial support helps us because it helps us buy licenses. It helps us get gas. It helps us get to where we need to go to the different events that people put on for us and the events that we put on for ourselves. I mean, the events that we put on for our heroes. So that, if there are any outfitters out there that want to donate some of their time or their location to bring some guys out, we keep small groups because we've dealt with bigger groups before. And it's not personal. There's 10 or 15 people running around. You got to be here. You got to be there. We keep it 3 to 5 on every event. That way it's a personal experience. That's where the family concept comes from. These started on our farm in Nashville, bringing people we didn't even know into our homes, pairing up with guides and family members and taking them out on these hunts on our farm. And we sit around our family dinner table, and that's where we started. We're very grassroots, and that's what we do. So the biggest thing we need help financially. We need places to take them to, and just spread the word in case there are people out there who don't know about us, who are in a bad place, who we can help. We're on Facebook. We're at Hero Hunt Inc. @gmail.com, and our website is herohuntinc.org.
So, listen, I wish you guys all the best. If you are looking for places to hunt in Virginia, let me know, because I know some folks who've got some land.
Oh, wow.
And again, I mean, this is just such a critical mission that you guys are on. Saw another story this morning, actually, of a veteran who committed suicide yesterday. Leaves behind a wife and 2 kids. This is happening every day. It's happening way too often. And you know, I want the men and women to know that they're not alone, that they don't have to feel this way, that there is help, and that there are people out there who understand. Like, I don't understand. I confess, I've never been in a war zone. I've never been in combat. Never served in law enforcement. But there are people out there who have those experiences, who can help, who do want to help, and are willing and waiting for folks to reach out. And they're trying to reach out as well. So thank you guys for what you're doing.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
We appreciate your time, and we appreciate the opportunity to come out and talk to you guys today. This advertising dollars are so expensive for us, but this gets it out in front of some people that maybe we can save some lives.
Joe, Jose, thank you both, sir.
Thank you, sir.
Great seeing you. Thanks so much. Hero Hunt, Inc. here at NRA Annual Meeting.
This actually is a gun that was very popular throughout the 18th century. It's a British all-metal, what we call a black watch Scottish pistol. Normally, this would be made out of wood.
Yeah, that is pretty different.
It's not. It's a beautiful metal. A lot of them sterling silver. You've got a very nice, elaborately engraved, faceted barrel. Beautiful little designs and flourishes on the hammer of the gun. It's a great little no trigger guard.
I was going to say that's some trigger on there too.
Yeah, nice little ball trigger. This is called a ram's head buttstock because it looks like, you know, the horns on a ram. And the neat thing is here we've got a this piece detaches and it's a frizzen prick. You can clean out the gun with it.
That's very cool.
Yeah. So it's
a very fancy, ornate gun.
Yeah.
So who would be, back in the day, what would be the kind of person who would own a firearm like this? Was it a functioning, but would something you use every day? Was it a showpiece? What was it?
Well, you see that there on this side, there's a belt hook. You can slide this over your belt, kind of doesn't need a holster. The most famous user of a pair of guns like this was Major John Pitcairn. We know his father, a famous explorer named Pitcairn Island out in the Pacific. But his son, John Pitcairn, is best known for being the British officer on the 19th of April in 1775 that ordered Captain John Parker at Lexington Green to throw down his arms. And Parker said, "Don't shoot until fired upon, but if they mean to have a war, let it begin here." And Pitcairn, leading those 300 British regulars that morning, had a brace of these guns.
Welcome back to Cam and Company. We're going to finish off today with Kurt Schlichter, senior columnist at Town Hall, talking about the Peruta case. We're also going to discuss Peruta a little bit with our next guest, Tim Lee, with the Center for Individual Freedom, on Twitter at CFIF Online and online at CFIF.org. Tim, I got to say, I'm disappointed that the court didn't take the case, but in a way I'm relieved that the court didn't take a case, because if the numbers aren't there, I don't want them to take this case yet. We've got other challenges that are still pending. And I can't get beyond the depressing fact that apparently we've got five justices on the Supreme Court that look at the Second Amendment and think that the right to keep and bear arms somehow stops at our front door.
Yeah, and it's an effective prohibition in California, as you've discussed before, and you and I have discussed before on this show, because when you prohibit a concealed carry, but also prohibit open carry, there's essentially no carry. And so to essentially prohibit the use of firearms for Second Amendment purposes has been accomplished through legislative action in California. So just the logical and application process of the law, you would think, would lead the court majority, which essentially still exists from the Heller decision. I mean, obviously, Gorsuch has replaced Scalia, but other than that, that majority remains intact. So that's a little bit depressing. The silver lining, of course, is that Gorsuch was one of the good justices on this case. Issue that we can perhaps at least look forward to, and you said, you know, if the numbers aren't there, we don't want the case coming before the court and getting a bad decision. At least this leaves the door open for other circuits to disagree, and maybe in future years with a better court, and again, I hope I'm not jinxing us here, but with a retirement of a Ruth Bader Ginsburg or a Stephen Breyer and a Kennedy and a different conservative majority on the court, maybe in subsequent years where there's more of a disagreement between the circuits, maybe the case does become ripe again for the Supreme Court to take a case and sort of decide it in the superior alternative. And so that's at least good as well. But yeah, I agree with you that you would think that the five-person majority that still believes in the Second Amendment right to keep and bear arms as an individual right, which has existed since the Heller decision, would see this California ban as, in effect, a total ban and take up the case. So that's disappointing. But, you know, the other disappointing news was that Kennedy didn't announce his retirement today. But, you know, maybe that comes a little bit later in the summer. So, you know, there's still room for optimism here. And I always like to play that role on your show.
Yeah, well, we'll see. David Latt at Above the Law said he doesn't think it's going to happen. He apparently had some sources from Kennedy's clerks who were meeting with Kennedy for their reunion over the weekend. And they said that that at the dinner, Kennedy did not sound like a guy who was planning a retirement. We shall see. But in the meantime, you know, here's where we are. And we've got some work to do. Thankfully, again, legislatively, I think we're building the case around the country that regardless of the opinions of the nine justices on the Supreme Court, it is the opinion of tens of millions of Americans that our right to keep and bear arms does exist beyond our front door, because we've got well over 10 million Americans who are currently exercising our right to carry legally, lawfully every day. And I think, you know, that we're just seeing those numbers grow. But there were a number of other cases that were announced today, either opinions released or the judges agreeing to hear a case. I want to talk about a couple of them with you. I don't know how much you've had a chance to look into some of these decisions, but the travel ban, the Trump travel ban, largely upheld by the court today. They say they're going to hear this in the fall, but in the meantime, the ban can stay in effect with the exception of individuals who have bona fide relationships to individuals or entities here in the United States. The only dissent on this, Tim, coming from the justices like Justice Gorsuch, who dissented to say, no, this should be restored in full.
Right.
Does this mean that the hashtag the resistance has sort of lost their biggest legal argument before this case is even really truly considered by the Supreme Court?
Well, here's one of the best ways of answering that question. Just look at the headlines that you're seeing from the mainstream media, which celebrated when the courts, the lower courts, put a block on President Trump's ban. You know, they were just in open celebration. There were almost fireworks in some of the headlines, metaphorically speaking, in celebration. You look today at some of the mainstream news organizations, and it's as though they're desperately looking for that silver lining. The bottom line here is it's a pretty broad rebuke to those lower courts, and rightfully so, regardless of your views on immigration. You know, people should have some problems with some of those lower courts stepping in, because this is an area with pretty broad executive leeway, and the founding fathers intended it that way. And so for the courts to have stepped in at the lower levels and blocked it was really, I think, an abuse of judicial power. But to answer your specific question, it was a narrow loss, but a broad victory for the Trump administration. And just the way that the mainstream media is handling it right now, you can sort of read those headlines and infer that they're pretty disappointed there. It's just like last week after the Georgia special election to replace Tom Price. You know, their frowns are too transparent at this point. So overall, it was a pretty big victory for the Trump administration.
All right. The last question regarding the Supreme Court today. Two cases dealing with religious liberty. One decided by the court today, 7-2 decision, dealing with a religious school and whether or not they were eligible for, I think it was playground funds, right, for secular funding. And that opinion was released today, 7-2 decision, saying, yes, in fact, these religious schools are eligible for these secular programs. The second one, the judges agreed to hear this case out of Colorado dealing with the Baker who did not want to bake a cake for the same-sex couple and was therefore sued. These both sounds like two big cases, although I think certainly the one that's going to be heard in the fall has gotten more attention. How big was the decision that the court released today, Tim? And then we'll talk about the case that they agreed to hear.
It's potentially enormous. And to explain why, go back a few years, and I'm going to get a little bit into the weeds here, and I'll try to stay at a 30,000-foot level for people who don't follow these issues. About 150 years ago, when Catholic immigrants were coming in and public schools taught primarily Protestant sorts of religious doctrines in public schools, Catholics opened up their own private schools. And so the government started passing what were called Blaine Amendments. B-L-A-I-N-E, after a politician at the time, I believe senator from Maine. What they were was thinly veiled discrimination against Catholic schools. And they said no public funds could be used on religious organizations, but everybody knew that meant Catholic schools. I'm not sure how those have survived through the years, because they're blatantly anti-First Amendment. And I'm speaking, by the way, right now, CFIF, we don't handle social issues, so I'm speaking purely from a personal point of view here. The First Amendment guarantees the right to free practice of religion, and these sorts of laws prohibiting public funds from going to schools for secular purposes, you know, to refurbish a playground, that has no religious purpose, obviously. They're openly discriminatory, and they infringe upon the First Amendment. And arguably, they violate the Establishment Clause as well, because they essentially establish non-religion or atheism or secularism as a state religion when you say that money that comes from the public can't be spent on schools. That's like telling somebody they can't spend their Social Security check on a church raffle or something of that sort. It just makes no sense whatsoever. So frankly, this is long overdue, and it's potentially enormous in its effect, because using this logic of Chief Justice Roberts' opinion here, those Blaine amendments that have existed for 150 years can't survive, because they openly discriminate against religious organizations simply because they are religious. And so, to give you another sort of analogy, there are cases from the Supreme Court where, you know, a public school, like a high school, would make its classrooms available for different clubs after school. So Model UN, you know, shooting club, football club, whatever. Obviously, you're not going to have, at a public school, have shooting clubs with live guns. But at any rate, you can't make them available for different organizations and different clubs, but then say, except for religious organizations, you guys can't meet. If you make them available to people, you've got to make them available to religious groups as well. You can't discriminate against religious groups simply because they are religious. That violates the First Amendment. And that's what the law in question here did. It said, we will give you money to refurbish your playground unless you happen to be a religious school or a religious organization. That's discrimination, pure and simple. The court reached the right decision. Again, I'm speaking personally, not on behalf of CFIF here, but the impact is potentially enormous to get rid of these laws once and for all.
All right. Now, what about the impact of the case that the court agreed to hear in the fall, the case dealing with the baker out in Colorado?
Yeah, that's another one where, again, I'm speaking personally.
Sure.
Here's the issue. A lot of people will try to say that it's no different for a bakery to deny participation in a gay wedding than it was 50 years ago during the civil rights era to serve a black customer. There's a huge difference, though, because in both cases, say, for instance, 50 years ago, somebody said, well, my religion prohibits, you know, serving somebody of a different race. Okay, well, even taking them at face value, the state law prohibiting discrimination would satisfy strict scrutiny, which is the highest test. When you're infringing upon somebody's religious views, you have to meet what's called strict scrutiny, meaning that it is an extremely important state interest that's being protected, and there's really no other way of going about protecting that interest. In the civil rights era, if you didn't force some of these vendors to sell to people that they perhaps didn't want to participate in commerce with, there was no other way to accomplish civil rights. In this case, though, it's so rare for a bakery to say, hey, look, and by the way, these bakeries don't say we won't serve gays. What they say is we don't want to participate in what we consider a violation of our religious principles in a gay wedding. And so, you know, it's not as though every bakery out there takes this position. And so, you know, if the state doesn't come in and force that person to engage in commerce, that the cake won't get baked or some of those sorts of things. So I don't think that strict scrutiny can be met nearly as easily, if at all, in this case. So that distinguishes it from the civil rights cases from about 50 years ago, just the degree to which it was impossible back then for, say, a black traveler going down the interstate or a different highway to find somebody who would serve them in the South. Whereas today, it's much more rare, and for the state to come in and violate the Free Exercise Clause, again, of the First Amendment, I'm not sure the government can meet its burden in that case. So that it may reach a different result. But that distinguishes today's cases freedom of practice from 50 years ago in the civil rights era. So people need to be careful about drawing a straight analogy between the two.
Talking again with Mr. Tim Lee with the Center for Individual Freedom. I appreciate all of the insight, Tim. I'll ask you one last question, and I won't even ask you this as an attorney, just as an American. What do you think about California's a ban on state-funded travel to Texas that apparently will not apply to things like state schools, competing in athletic events, and things like that? Is this pure grandstanding in your mind?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and it's said to be on the basis of protecting various classes, but then they allow commerce and travel to other places that are openly cruel to some of the groups that California purports to protect. And so it's absolute grandstanding. Frankly, I think it's a lot of anger that people are wising up and moving from California to places like Texas, as liberal policies drive California into the ground. So maybe it's their own way of lashing out at that. So, yeah, it's ridiculous. It doesn't withstand logical scrutiny or moral scrutiny, frankly, because they engage in commerce and trade and everything else with other states and even countries that are much worse in that regard. So it's grandstanding. It's tawdry. But as somebody who lived in California for about 15 years, frankly, I can't say it's terribly surprising, unfortunately.
There you go. Mr. Lee, as always, sir, good talking with you. Hope we get a chance to do it again soon.
Thanks a lot, everybody. Have a great week.
You too, sir. Tim Lee, join us from the Center for Individual Freedom. All right, when we come back, we're going to talk with a high-powered and high-priced California attorney, Kurt Schlichter, senior columnist at Town Hall. We'll get his legal thoughts on the Peruta case, maybe some non-legal thoughts as well, although I hope that Kurt will keep in mind this is family-friendly radio. Stick around. We've got more Cam and Company coming up right after this.
We've got some of the gun collectors over here for special curators corners. I love it. I love it. I love it. Who's up next, gentlemen?
We've got Martin Ivey with the Dallas Arms Collectors Association, and they brought one of the most popular displays this year.
Wonder why.
Well, this was certainly at the center of it.
Let me tell you, before we came up to record these, Dana Lash was up here doing a show, and the buzz was going around because you were walking around with that here. And it was, what is that guy? Who is that guy and what's he doing? So we know who you are, Martin. What is it?
What we have here is a RPG-7 grenade launcher. It's deactivated, of course, with a deactivated grenade in it. It is from the mid-80s era. This one actually came to us via the Israelis, as did many of the weapons that were used in Afghanistan. It was a strange, strange bedfellow situation. The Israelis, the CIA, supplied a lot of weapons, comm block weapons that were captured in the 67 and 73 Arab-Israeli wars. The CIA bought them from the Israelis and provided them to their enemies, basically, fundamentalist Islamic Mujahideen in Afghanistan to fight the Russians.
Wow. Well, this thing's been around. So how did it find its way from there to you?
I've been in collecting Soviet military for 35 years.
You have any tanks?
No.
That's next, right? Yeah.
Martin's published a book on AK-47 bayonets. It's the reference work on the subject.
All right. So who wants to handle telling us a little bit about this thing technically? What does it do? How does it work?
It's basically a rocket-assisted shaped charge grenade. It's an anti-tank weapon. The Mujahideen actually also used them to shoot down helicopters, which is a neat trick.
Well, that's got to be a good shot to do that.
Yeah. It has an expulsion charge it fires very similar to a regular firearm. It has a hammer trigger, strikes a firing pin, explodes a primer, sets off a charge that is wrapped around a telfin assembly, bolts the grenade from the launcher tube, the grenade goes down 15 to 25 meters, and the rocket booster kicks in. Mm-hmm. And then as it hits, it's a standard-shaped charge, explodes, and it has about a kilo, 2.2 pounds of Semtex or some similar plastic explosive with a metal cone. And we'll, you know, take out most light armor. And
it's party time.
Yeah.
Get that thing downrange.
I have a little bit of personal experience with one of these.
Uh-oh. Do we want to hear the story? Should we screen it for? No, go ahead.
No. Well, there was language that's inappropriate for television, which is not uncommon when one whistles across the front end of your Humvee when you're driving down towards Baghdad.
Yeah.
They evidently, some Iraqis were upset with their marksmanship skills, because they were shooting these all over the place and they weren't hitting what they were aiming at. So taking a tip from Ben Franklin, they started tying cloth tails to them, thinking a kite works on a kite. Why not an RPG? And so the vocabulary there followed, what was that, as it went across the front end of the Humvee. We realized they weren't actually targeting us. They aimed for the oil pipeline that was about 100 yards past us. We just happened to be in the way when they fired it off. They actually hit the oil pipeline. But the ones we saw in Iraq, actually right here, Martin, these numbers, this says 1978, does it? Where was this one made, do you know?
This it has a double circle 10 stamp on it, which means it's Bulgarian.
The ones in Iraq actually say "Made in Baghdad," written in English.
Wow!
Right at this point on the trigger guard.
That's beautiful. So
cool. I think every country in the world has made an RPG at one point. The U.S. makes an RPG. I don't know if you guys know that.
Did not know that.
Well, we're almost out of time here, so thank you so much, Martin, for sharing. And wow, that's some impressive
thanks
thing.
Thanks for having
here.
Me.
I think it's the first time on Curator's Corner we've actually had an RPG on. So, guys, thank you so much for being on Curator's Corner on NRA TV.
Welcome.
Oh, so glad that you are with us here on Cam and Company on NRA TV, Sirius XM Patriot 125. I wish we were talking about some better news here. The Supreme Court taking the Pruta case. Unfortunately, they decided not to take the case today. A written dissent by Justice Clarence Thomas, joined by Neil Gorsuch, and we are joined by one Kurt Schlichter, senior columnist at Town Hall, author of Indian Country on Twitter, at Kurt Schlichter. Kurt, greetings from the United States of America.
Hey! Well, here I am in California, which apparently doesn't feel compelled to recognize basic civil rights. Yay. Look, I think... I think this, while it's not good news, because I'd like this to be this to be resolved, so that someone who was, you know, an Army colonel who'd been in two wars, carried weapons in California on disaster missions and riots and things, who's been a lawyer for 20-some years, who had a top-secret security clearance, who's qualified with a pistol, could actually go out and have some, you know, two-year clerk say, oh, yeah, you're probably qualified to know when you can carry a gun or not. But of course that doesn't happen here in California. I think what it shows is, the rest of the court is terrified, that the decision would be in favor of freedom. They don't want to hear it because they think they'll lose.
I think that you're right. Again, you know, we don't know the reasons why the members of the court decided not to hear the case. I think that you're right. I argued earlier that that there really is no good argument, and they don't want to make that bad argument. They you know, you can't. I mean, Kurt, again, let's just read it. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. What about that makes you say, okay, well, that doesn't mean you can carry a gun outside of your home?
Yeah, it seems. Oh, well, you know, it seems very open to infringement to me. No. look, courts of appeal work in weird ways. I'm sitting here working on, you know, appeals in, as we speak. In fact, appeals in cases you've heard of.
Uh-huh.
And what the courts do does not always necessarily mean what one would think. Mm-hmm. There are, Peruta is a procedurally messy case.
Mm-hmm.
It was originally went up a district court, then a three-judge panel went one way, then the court itself came back and on bonk and brought in a bunch of the Ninth Circuit guys, some of whom I've argued in front of in the last year. In the meantime, some laws in California had changed. Laws are still changing in California. So it is a procedural moving target. Doesn't mean they couldn't have taken it or shouldn't have taken it. It's entirely possible that the rest of the court that's inclined to toss out these kind of anti-freedom rules are looking for a more procedurally sound case to take up.
You may be right.
I don't know if that's so.
Well, you may be right. Justice Thomas and Justice Gorsuch clearly think the court's just trying to avoid taking these cases.
There are at least four judges on there who are desperate to avoid taking the cases.
Yeah, and you're right. That fifth judge, you don't necessarily know the motivations. But having said that, look, there is a Peruta 2 case that is making its way through the court system. The Ninth Circuit had said, well, this isn't really about the right to carry. This is about whether or not you have a constitutional right to carry a concealed handgun in public. Peruta 2 is simply asking again, okay, fine. We don't agree with you that was the question, but we're going to go ahead and ask the broader question now, and you will be forced to answer this broader question, hopefully. Although the gears of justice can grind kind of slowly,
and the Supreme Court certainly looked at that. Again, that's the procedural thing. Mm. The courts like things that are procedurally clean, and because it's bad cases, confused cases make bad law. And there may be some advantage for it. You may not want to take a case with a lot of weird facts, because then instead of announcing a black letter law principle, you make it a fact-specific analysis, which really doesn't that leaves both sides wiggle room. So, and I'm just guessing here, man. We're just reading tea leaves, looking for smoke. Is it brown? Is it white? Who knows? we don't know. What's certain is, at some point they will, and time is not on the bad guy's side. Justice Kennedy has a small but real chance of retiring this year, more next year. I'd rather him do it this year because he turns all the Senate races in turmoil next year, although that might be to our advantage. The weight of history and the way and the way political power is going is in our favor. It's great to see that Justice Gorsuch immediately jumped in for freedom, did not hesitate, and aggressively pursued a chance to address California's unwillingness to obey what we clearly know is in the Constitution. This is obstructionism, pure and simple, and these are the tools of losers.
And Kurt, when you look at what's upheld, basically, the current system in California is I guess acceptable, or at least it's not going to be challenged by the Supreme Court. You've got a two-tier system in place where if you lived in even I think Ventura County as a coastal county, it recognizes self-defense as a valid reason to get a concealed carry license.
There are a lot of there are a lot of problems with California, and I don't think in any way, shape, or form that the denial of certiorari, that is the court not taking up this particular Peruta case, does not indicate to me that the majority of the court does not believe there's a problem. My guess, and again, it's only a guess, is they are awaiting a more procedurally
clean,
appropriate case. There's a good argument, and Thomas and Gorsuch made it, that you don't want to wait. But Roberts was a pro-weapons guy. Gun rights guy. Alito absolutely is.
Mm-hmm.
I think Kennedy is too. There's a reason that they didn't join in, because I think you only need five judges or four judges.
You need four to hear the case and then five to win.
Yeah. And there is some good reason that Sam Alito didn't say, yeah, let's take this case. And I don't know what it is.
Well,
it is certainly not, well, you know, I don't really believe in it.
And again, this is where we get into the speculation, because we don't actually know who voted what way. We know that the two individuals signed on to this dissent, but Alito has signed on. I think Alito actually wrote a dissent previously, basically echoing what Justice Thomas said today, that, you know, it's past time for the court to hear a case. I mean, I thought it was amazing, Kurt. Justice Thomas said since 2010, the last time they heard a Second Amendment case, the court's heard 35 First Amendment cases, 25 Fourth Amendment cases, and not one dealing with the Second Amendment.
Yeah, because they know the liberal minority knows it's going to lose. So it will never bring one up. Now, if Hillary had her way, oh, yeah, Perrutt'd be up. Oh, yeah. If Hillary had appointed Merrick Garland or some other leftist, oh, yeah, they'd be all up. They are trying to keep the court from ruling, hoping against hope that, you know, the facts on the ground will change and they will have somebody more hospitable to, you know, fascism.
Talking again with Kurt Schlichter, senior columnist at Town Hall. And as you say, this very well, you know, the Supreme Court could be another huge issue in the midterms. And if that's so, Kurt, I would say that that's going to be problematic for Democrats, because, you know, you can get rid of
problem.
I do too. Listen, you can get rid of Nancy Pelosi as the leader of the Democrat Party. I think there's a new poll out showing 58% of Democrats want to do that. But again, if you're looking then at putting another Sonia Sotomayor or another Elena Kagan or another Justice Ginsburg on the court or another Justice John Paul Stevens, right, that's going to basically always rule in favor of the power of the government over your individual lives, that I think is going to be unacceptable to a lot of Americans.
Well, look, you know, next year there are a lot of red states with senators and who are Democrats, and they're going to get up there and say, yeah, you vote against Gorsuch. Gorsuch wanted to preserve our Second Amendment rights. You'll get in there and, you know, you'll vote again for somebody to, you'll vote to confirm somebody to throw away our gun rights. And I think that's going to be very powerful, because you know what, Cam? We're woke.
Are woke.
See, that's the problem. That's the risk I think the liberals didn't see, which is they get in our face so much, and we have a lot of patience. But eventually we start paying attention. And once we're awake and aware, now we're always watching them, and suddenly it gets hard. And suddenly, the smartest, most accomplished woman in the world doesn't get elected. Why? Because they've been rubbing our faces in it. They overplayed their hand.
And
we all know we know our right to keep and bear arms depends on maintaining the Supreme Court, which depends on maintaining the presidency, which means maintaining the Senate. We know that. And we are one-issue voters when it comes to freedom.
Absolutely. Kurt, listen, we are unfortunately almost out of time, but I do very much appreciate your perspective. I know you're going to keep fighting for the Second Amendment there behind the beaded curtain.
Yeah.
And we'll be talking again very soon.
Thanks.
All right. Thank you, sir. Kurt Schlichter on Twitter at Kurt Schlichter. Meanwhile, Alabama's attorney general sounding off on the decision today by the Supreme Court not to hear the Perrutt case. Alabama, one of 26 states, asking the court to hear this case. Attorney General Steve Marshall said it is patently absurd to believe that the constitutional right of Americans to bear arms is confined to the four walls of their places of residence. Yet, that is effectively the view that the Supreme Court endorsed today in its decision to let stand a California federal court decision upholding a ban on the carry of firearms in public in San Diego County. Again, Alabama, 25 other states submitted a friend of the court brief back in February. Asserting, quote, the San Diego County Sheriff's licensing scheme effectively bans the core right of to bear arms for ordinary law-abiding citizens and consequently violates the Second Amendment. The experience of the amici states, those states submitting that brief, demonstrates that the restrictions on bearing arms in San Diego County cannot withstand any level of scrutiny. Although the amici state share the same compelling interest in protecting the health and safety of their citizens, they've been able to do so without curtailing the fundamental right of their citizens to bear arms. Well, indeed. As a matter of fact, we've got just a couple of minutes here. Let's take a look at something real quick, shall we? Because, again, this is all about public safety for California, right? We're making places safer by restricting this right to carry. So, California, violent crime rate, 2015. The violent crime rate in California, 426.3 per 100,000 people. The homicide rate, 4.8 per 100,000 people. Let's go across the border of California into Arizona, shall we? And let's take a look at what's going on in the state of Arizona. Let's see. Violent crime, 410.2. That's lower than California's. Homicide rate of 4.5, which is also lower than the state of California's. In Arizona, you have constitutional carry. You can carry without a license there in the state of Arizona. Now, they still have their concealed carry licensing process, and as a matter of fact, there are still plenty of Arizonans, hundreds of thousands of them, who are concealed carry holders. But what is not required to carry lawfully? As long as you can lawfully possess that firearm, you can lawfully carry it in Arizona. That's been the law since 2010. Homicides declined every year since the law was put into effect. Homicide went up in California last year. So public safety? Yeah, Alabama's Attorney General is right. You can actually improve public safety without banning law-abiding people from legally carrying a firearm. As a matter of fact, why would you think that that's the best way to reduce violent crime? All right, that's going to do it for this edition of Cam and Company. We'll see you tomorrow.